Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
She's my friends, but I'm in France. I'm just saying.
Naomi Osaka, the second-ranked woman in tennis and the highest-paid female athlete in the world, has quit the French Open. Osaka had announced last week she would be skipping press conferences at the tournament, citing concerns for her mental health. She followed through on that promise yesterday. After winning in the first round, tennis officials responded with a $15,000 fine and threats of further penalties. Today, Osaka shared on social media that she would withdraw and eventually hopes to, quote, work with the tour to discuss ways we can make things better for the players, press, and fans. John Wertheim of Sports Illustrated is in Paris. He's at the Open. He joins us now. Hey, John.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm all right. Thank you. How surprising is this? What do you make of Naomi Osaka's decision?
It's been a very strange several days, even by tennis standards. It's really regrettable. It's really unfortunate. I mean, I think Naomi Osaka's mental health ought to be our paramount concern, but no one has covered themselves in glory here. This was a situation that escalated quickly and didn't have to. This has been a big surprise. I mean, Roger Federer played today. Serena Williams played today. And the big story of the day is obviously Naomi Osaka's withdrawal.
Yeah, not out on the courts today. I gather the French Tennis Federation made a statement to journalists today, called her withdrawal unfortunate, wished her well, and in an irony that was, I'm guessing, not lost on you, the French Tennis Federation president did not take any questions at the press conference today.
Is it a press conference if you don't take questions? Yeah, I mean, there are so many levels of irony and concentric circles of irony, but the French Federation took a very hardline stance, and, you know, at some level, you know, the shots were fired and bluffs were called, and Naomi Osaka is no longer in the tournament, and now they're backpedaling a little bit.
She wrote in her post today about how she has suffered long bouts of depression since the 2018 U.S. Open. Can you just remind us what happened there?
At the 2018 U.S. Open, she plays her first big final. She plays Serena Williams, and that was a controversial match that people remember, where Serena Williams was penalized for conduct, and Naomi Osaka wins this tournament, wins this match, and yet she's booed. To her absolute credit, she won the very next major event she played. She's won two more since then. She's won four majors. So this is a player who had this fairly strange, if not traumatic, first breakthrough, but then recovered and really established herself as this bona fide star. Her mental health challenges, that is not a secret. I mean, she has said at one point, you know, I am weird. It's kind of a fact. And she's spoken very openly and admirably. And I think that's one of the things that's so sort of maddening about this, that anyone with a little bit of nuance and a little bit of context knew that her announcement was an athlete's, I mean, really, a cry for help is really what it was. This was about an athlete who felt broken. This was not any sort of act of defiance. This was not an entitled athlete who was blowing off a convention. I mean, this was someone who was wounded, and it's really a pity that the tennis administrators didn't know it.
Just 30 seconds or so left, but to her point about wanting to make things better, to get the rules changed on this, how likely is that?
I think we can all examine whether these press conferences that she finds can be so traumatic, if that's the best way to do business. I think a lot of this is about her and about her getting to a healthier space. And I suspect when she does, it's not going to be about making institutional changes. I think she just wasn't up to the press conference format, and that really wasn't handled with a great deal of sensitivity.
That is John Wertheim, executive editor and senior writer for Sports Illustrated, talking to us from Paris about Naomi Osaka and her decision today to pull out of the French Open. Thank you, John.
Thanks, Mary Louise.
The deaths of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and others at the hands of police have elevated conversations about race and policing throughout the country. And when it comes to children, initiating and navigating how to talk about race can be complicated. To help with those conversations, Sesame Street is developing new resources, adding new Muppets to help teach children racial literacy and understanding. I recently spoke with Jeanette Betancourt and Kay Wilson-Stallings from Sesame Workshop on their approach to tackling difficult topics and about the two newest members of the Muppet family. Kay, this has been a tough year for parents on so many different levels, but one of them has been how to have conversations about race, about justice with children. When you were working on coming up with how these conversations could take place, what was going through your mind?
You know, at Sesame Street, we've often tackled really tough topics and have always been a model for parents and caregivers on how to have those conversations. And when, you know, the events that happened last summer, culminating in the murder of George Floyd, we decided that we needed to have this tough topic, this tough conversation about race and racial justice. And as a company, we made that our goal and initiative to help parents and caregivers talk to children about racial justice. And, you know, we know that children from a very early age see differences. They see color differences in skin. They see eye shapes. They hear language differences. And so to ignore it and to think that that's not something that kids are aware of is really wrong. And at Sesame Street, we've always modeled multiculturalism and inclusiveness and diversity. But we decided that we needed to do more than that, and that we really needed to lean in and be explicit and bold in talking to children about racial justice.
Jeanette, part of this includes two new Muppets. Tell us a little bit about them.
A little bit is that we wanted to model those conversations. And we also heard in our process of learning from both parents and caregivers, as well as advisors, that how do you present a safe space to do that? And we know the immediate connection with our wonderful Muppets, but we also felt in that deep commitment that Kay describes that we need to represent it in a realistic way. So we developed a wonderful Muppet who's Elijah, who's a dad and he's a meteorologist, and his son Wesley, who's curious and he enjoys the outdoors and is always asking, again, being a five-year-old, the kinds of questions that we know children ask of their parents. So by modeling it through the eyes of the dad and his son, we feel that we're then modeling for all parents and caregivers.
Where should a parent lead that child in conversation?
Well, the first thing that a parent shouldn't do is ignore the question. And what happens often is that children see things and they question, and parents sometimes have a tendency to shush them and to say, look this way, you know, don't look there and don't ask that question. You shouldn't ask that question. And so then children develop this idea that there's something wrong with the observations that they have. It's something wrong with the questions that they have. And then what could tend to happen is kids then can come up with their own conclusions. If they're not having these conversations about why someone's skin is a different color than their own, then they will make up their own reason for that, right? And I mean, many of us have had experiences where I remember when my son was very young and he was on the playground with a child who was a white child and they were holding hands and they were playing together. They had just met. And I saw this white child take my son's hand and rub his skin because he thought that it would come off because he didn't have that understanding. And so it's really incumbent on parents and caregivers to have those conversations. As challenging as they might be, as Jeanette said, it's really important because otherwise kids are going to come up with their own conclusions.
Jeanette, so how do the Muppets deal with this? How should we expect a police shooting or a tragedy of some sort to make it through into Sesame Street in a way that a five-year-old understands and isn't intimidated by?
So we decided to begin with the basics of conversation. So our first explanation of race is actually the physicality of race. How does really melanin, a physical piece of all of our bodies, explain the differences in skin color? And in so doing, we have Elijah, we have Wesley, and we have Elmo asking a question based on something that happens. He picks up a leaf and he's wondering, why is that leaf such a different color? And it leads to this wonderful introduction about the physicality of race.
Elmo has a question.
Oh, what is it, Elmo?
Well, Elmo wants to know, why Russ's skin is brown.
Oh, I know why, Elmo. My mom and dad told me. It's because of melanin. Right, Dad?
That's right.
And again, two things on that is the child's perspective. That moment of curiosity, and it's Kay just explaining that very, very personal story, it's taking advantage of those everyday moments. From there, though, we are and will be, as we're going through our content launching, dealing more specifically with visual encounters and how to then look at what that impact has when there is something that is stated unfairly or it's unkind or disrespectful. What is the impact on the child, on the adults? And so again, we model that from a child's perspective, keeping in mind that these are young children, and we want to make sure those conversations reflect realities, but also provide a level of comfort and way to talk about them.
Jeanette Betancourt and Kay Wilson-Stallings from the Sesame Workshop. Thank you both.
Thank you.
The farmer in the dell, the farmer in the dell. Hi-ho, the derry-o, the farmer in the dell.
The massive COVID relief package includes billions for the U.S. Department of Agriculture to wipe away the debt of farmers of color. But these farmers have been promised relief before to make up for decades of discrimination, and many are skeptical that this time will be different, as Emma Hurt of member station WABE in Atlanta reports.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack is in Fort Valley, Georgia on a sunny Saturday morning, trying to convince a group of black farmers to trust his department again.
No surprise here, I'm a white guy from the Midwest, and I'm hot. So if you don't mind, I'm going to take my coat off. Is that all right?
Vilsack lays out the details of an estimated $4 billion in debt forgiveness for farmers of color, which he says will begin this month. His trip and the relief are a big deal, an acknowledgement of long-standing discrimination at his own agency's hands.
When people do not have full access to the broad array of services and benefits at the Department of Agriculture, they have been at a severe disadvantage. Right? Farmers obviously had the full advantage. They had all the programs. And so they had a chance to grow, to expand.
As a result, over the years, a skepticism of the USDA has deepened, and it affects how some farmers view this latest relief package.
It's like the fox watching the hen house.
John Boyd is president of the National Black Farmers Association. He's a Virginia farmer who became an advocate decades ago after facing loan discrimination himself.
Just about every 8.5 to 9 years, something happens in this issue. And I don't have many more 8.5 or 9 years left in my span here to get some real significant change in place so that we can save the next generation of black farmers.
Report after government report has documented how little government help black farmers have received, all while they've lost millions of acres of farmland. Lloyd Wright ran the Civil Rights Division of the USDA in the 90s. He was hired to deal with a backlog of discrimination complaints that the department, he says, had basically ignored for years. He understands why farmers are skeptical of the government's new promise.
When farmers tell you they're not sure yet, well, if you'd gone through the history for the last 150 years, you wouldn't be either.
In 1999, black farmers won the largest civil rights class action settlement in U.S. history for discrimination by the department. But thousands of claims were denied because they didn't meet certain conditions, and nearly 60,000 were rejected for being late. Wright calls the case, known as Pigford, a disappointment.
Black farmers have a very, very, very negative opinion of it because the outcome was not in the best interest of black farmers.
To address those late claims, in 2011, the Obama administration and then Ag Secretary Vilsack allocated another $1 billion for a second settlement. But there were accusations of non-farmers winning claims, all while farmers who'd already been denied, like Lucius Abrams from Keysville, Georgia, were blocked from applying.
Any bump in the road, I know it. I've been there.
Weeks before Vilsack's trip, Abrams spoke to a group of fellow Georgia farmers at an event organized by Senator Raphael Warnock. Abrams has been appealing his denial for decades without success, accumulating more debt and fighting foreclosure along the way.
I want to ask you a question. If you go stick your hand in a hole and a rattlesnake bite it the first time, and you go back there the second time and stick your hand in the hole, you bite it the second time, what you think you do the third time?
Secretary Vilsack vows this time is different. The process is simpler and without conditions.
It's not the beginning and end.
with our announcement today, it's the beginning of a beginning.
Ironically, fewer than 10% of farmers of color could qualify for this because most don't get their loans from the government. Many don't try after the horror stories. The department is committed to changing that status quo, but it won't happen overnight, says Dwayne Goldman, a black farmer from Arkansas and the USDA's new racial equity advisor.
This is not a speedboat that we're changing direction. This is a huge barge in the slow-moving stream. It's going to take some time to change course.
There's been pushback on this money. Several white farmers have sued the department, calling the relief discrimination against them. Secretary Vilsack's response?
To a white farmer who thinks that, gosh, somebody's getting something I'm not getting. Now maybe you might feel some sympathy for the folks for the last 100 years who've had to feel that way.
Less than 0.1% of last year's COVID relief for farmers went to farmers of color. For NPR News, I'm Emma Hurt in Fort Valley, Georgia.
Tell me who paid reparations on my soul. Who paid reparations? 'Cause I don't dig segregation, but I can't get integration. I got to take it to the United Nations. Someone to help me away from this station. Tell me who paid reparations on my soul.
For more than a century, the Virginia Theological Seminary relied on the forced labor of black Americans. Now the seminary is sending annual cash payments of $2,100 to the descendants of those people. It's one of the first cash reparations programs in the country, and it's meant to recognize the black people who worked on campus for little or no money during the time of slavery, Reconstruction, and Jim Crow. Ian Markham is president and dean of the seminary, and he proposed the reparations program. Welcome to All Things Considered.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
And we're also joined by Gerald Wanzer. His great-grandfather and other family members worked at the seminary, and he's one of the beneficiaries or shareholders in the program. So good to have you here as well.
Good afternoon. Glad to be here.
Mr. Wanzer, were you surprised when you heard that the seminary was going to start cutting checks?
I was skeptical and also elated just to think that all of a sudden it's come up a program that was going to give recognition and retribution to the people who worked there in the past.
Dean Markham, so many politicians, universities, other institutions are wrestling with this issue and not taking action. Tell us about how you decided to just start the program.
Well, we're a seminary and we're approaching our 200th milestone as an institution. And we felt it was partly our Christian obligation to sit and think about who we are and the journey we've made and what's happened over those 200 years. And in a very real sense, we had forgotten, we had overlooked, we had ignored the deep debt this institution owed African Americans in particular. And we took the view that we should not mark our 200th anniversary without really looking at our history. And part of that work needs to recognize that we did not compensate the labor of those who were there in the pre-Civil War period. And in addition, we only paid less to African Americans than we did our white employees under Jim Crow. So we determined that the right thing to do was to create a reparations fund. And as we track down those to whom we have a debt, we will start making payments to them.
So as you say, part of this project is finding the descendants of the people who worked at the seminary and unearthing the stories of those laborers. Gerald, I understand you have learned some of those stories of your ancestors for the first time. Tell us about what you've discovered about your relatives.
My great-grandfather, Wallace Wanzer, was a blacksmith, and he worked there. He was born in 1838, so he was enslaved, and he probably, most likely, helped to do the miller work on that institution.
You know, there have been so many discussions about reparations taking the form of educational programs or housing grants, and this is one of the few, perhaps the first, that is actually giving money, cash payments. Ian, how did you settle on that form of reparations?
The truth is that these estates, Gerald Wanzer's estate, was deprived of income because the seminary did not pay his forebears for their labor. And to my mind, that's as simple as that. When you pay people for labor, you do not then designate what it should be spent on. That's the prerogative of the recipient. And when it's paid into their estate, it's the prerogative of the descendants. And therefore, to my mind, this is simple. You send them a check and you say, this is a small token of compensation that should have gone to your forebears. It now comes to the estate and you're a beneficiary. Please spend it how you like. That's what everybody else does when they get compensation for their labor. That's what you do. That's what I do. That's what we should do here too.
It seems like such a difficult thing to put a dollar amount, and yet that was what the seminary had to do, right? I mean, it's, I believe, 1% of the total endowment, about $1.7 million. How did you put a dollar figure on this commitment?
So the reason why it was $1.7 million is that, you know, we have a program that we've got to deliver. We've got an institution we've got to run. We've got a mission we've got to deliver. So it's a seed. It must grow. And as we make deeper and continuing connections with descendants of those people that we exploited, we will expand this fund. And for me, one of the most important things and one of the delights of seeing Gerald is that we're building a relationship with Gerald. So we celebrated his 77th birthday on the campus, which was the highlight of my year. And Gerald has dining rights at the campus whenever he chooses as a beneficiary of the program. And we invite them to be part of the Virginia Theological Seminary community.
Gerald, what does that mean to you? What does it represent to you?
It means a lot. First of all, I must say that a lot of the descendants are not happy with the program. And I have a brother that's 90 years old, and he just seems to be put off by all of a sudden, here we got come up with people, white people, trying to come up and repair what happened in the past. But I don't agree with him.
Well, tell us how you feel about it. What does it mean to you?
I feel, show me the money. but I'm all for it. I'm all for it because at last, we get some type of recognition. That's the word, recognition.
Ian, you lead the institution that enslaved Gerald's ancestors. And so, just to conclude, as the voice of that institution, is there anything that you would like to say directly to Gerald?
Gerald, I want you to know that I'm on behalf of the institution that committed that crime against your ancestors, I utter a deep and profuse apology for the hurt and injury that we inflicted. And I also want you to know that we want to do everything we can to build relationships with you and your family as part of a vision, a future that will be different, where all of God's people will be included and treated with respect and equality.
Gerald, would you like to respond?
Yes, I accept your apology directly on my behalf. Like I said, there's a lot of other people that's not happy, but at least it's a start. And we have to start from somewhere. And this is a great, great beginning. I'd like to thank you for your efforts and for what has come about.
Ian Markham is the president and dean of the Virginia Theological Seminary, and Gerald Wanzer is one of the shareholders in the reparations program. Thank you both.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Wet t-shirts in the crowd. She look hot, throw it in the crowd.
We don't need no water.
Take a long bubble bath, let my feet hang out.
We don't need no water.
Drink it all up, then I'm peeing it out.
We don't need no water, let that motherfucker burn. Burn, 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 burn. We don't need no water.
Mayor
Governor Lori Lightfoot issued a moratorium on water shutoffs, but some Chicagoans have been living without running water during the COVID-19 pandemic. City officials teamed up with local organizations to reconnect water service, but it hasn't been easy. WBEZ's Maria Inesimudio brings us the story.
Tina is shuffling water bills and pages of notes. She's trying to make sense of how she ended up living without water.
My water bill for the year of 2019 always ran no higher than $60. April 14, 2020, which was $257. The one after that came in at $1,038.
We're now using Tina's last name because of the stigma of living without water. She called the water department multiple times looking for answers.
And I called back and she said, no, you have a water leak. I said, I don't have a water leak. I've checked everywhere and the bill keeps going up higher. She said, you have to hire a contractor. So at that time I did call in a contractor and he said water was leaking somewhere up underground.
She had to replace the pipe connecting her home to the city's water supply. An expensive fix to the leak. The 66-year-old woman couldn't afford it. Not the cost of replacing the pipe or the hundreds of dollars in monthly water bills. She decided to turn the water off herself. She harvested water every morning by temporarily turning the water back on.
I had a brand new rain barrel, and I started filling that up with water, and I put it on my back porch. And that's how I continued to have water in the house. Once I filled the rain barrel up, then I turned the water off so that the bill wouldn't keep going up higher and higher.
She lived this way for 10 months.
Yeah, I know. Get in here and dig around. You know, yeah.
On a recent Friday morning, workers are digging to replace a water meter in Chicago's Woodlawn neighborhood. These employees have been working throughout the pandemic to maintain water services or to restore them. But restoring water is challenging for many reasons. It's been difficult identifying who's living without water, and the water department can't restore services alone. They need help from local organizations to pay for major repairs, and in some cases, to help residents restore other essential utilities. Officials say they can't restore water services to home without heat to avoid pipes bursting during the winter. Water Commissioner Andrea Chang says since the start of the pandemic, the water department has restored water to 35 households, and another 25 homes are in the process.
That's all really done in coordination. We actually have weekly meetings where we have our case management. We go through each case, case by case, get updates from all parties involved, and see what the next steps are so that we don't let anybody fall between the cracks.
Cheng's approach helped Tina restore her water. The finance department enrolled her in the Utilities Billing Relief Program, a program that will cut her water bill in half. If she pays on time every month, her debt will be forgiven too. And the city partnered with Elevate Chicago to cover the cost of fixing the leak. Ann Evans is with Elevate.
For many of us, our bills are just too high and our incomes are too low.
Working class families often cannot afford home repairs. Elevate is trying to close that gap.
Sometimes we're running completely new water service lines. So that's a complexity that requires pulling a permit because you're digging up the street in that kind of situation. We've even replaced entire plumbing systems.
This type of help is essential, she said. Officials say they want Chicagoans living without water to come forward and ask for help. You can do that by calling 311. Marina Zamudio, WBEZ News.
For years, Nestle, the world's largest food and beverage company, has bottled Michigan's water for next to nothing and sold it at great profit. Now, the state has greenlit the company's request to pump even more, despite widespread opposition. And all Nestle has to pay for these millions of gallons of water it gets a year is $200. And this in a territory where Native American tribes have treaty rights.
There is a perception around the world that Nestle goes into poor communities with lax regulations, entices them with the promise of jobs, and then takes their water, sells it back to them at a profit.
We have to go where the water's at.
What do you think Nestle should do?
Go home to Switzerland.
The world's largest food company, Nestle, has said it's trying to update its health strategy after reportedly acknowledging that many of its products would be classified as unhealthy. Andrew Walker has more details.
The document says that some of Nestle's products will never be healthy, the Financial Times reported. It compares the company's products with international standards for healthy foods, and some perform poorly, particularly due to high salt or sugar content. Most of the company's mainstream food and drink products do badly, although the calculation excludes others such as medical nutrition, coffee and pet food. Including those would improve the figures. The company has said it's working on updating its approach to nutrition and health.
Andrew Walker.
The hunt is on. And you're the prey.
It's known as the Red Summer, but it actually stretched well into the fall of 1919. From April through November of that year, a wave of white mobs attacked black communities in cities across the country, killing hundreds, if not thousands, of civilians. Red Summer refers to the blood they shed. Washington Post staff writer Deneen Brown has investigated this history closely. She helped make two new documentaries from National Geographic and PBS about the 1921 race massacre in her hometown of Tulsa, Oklahoma. She told us we actually should think of the Red Summer as not one season, but several years of racist violence.
Well, I argue that Red Summer actually began in 1917 in East St. Louis, Illinois, when white mobs attacked black people, pulling them off of streetcars, beating them. That was a reign of terror that engulfed at least 26 cities, included Washington, D.C., Chicago, Omaha, Elaine, Arkansas, Charleston, South Carolina, Knoxville, Houston. These attacks set the stage for the 1921 Tulsa race massacre.
Can you take us back to this period in time in terms of what was going on with these black communities? I'm thinking of post-war, post-pandemic, and also the start of the Great Migration. But how does this play out in terms of black and white communities coming up against each other?
Okay, so Red Summer coincides with the second resurgence of the Klan. There were police chiefs, there were police officers, there were mayors, there were governors, there were senators who were proud members of the Klan. They actually carried Klan cards. It also coincides with the Great Migration, when you see millions of black people fleeing the South for cities in the North and also cities in the West. They encounter white people who are angry over the competition for jobs and also for voting power. This period coincides with what historians call the New Negro. That means black people were no longer subservient. This was a period when black soldiers were returning from World War I. They were expecting human rights. They had been willing to die to defend their country. There's a famous quote by W.E.B. Du Bois, who wrote, "We return from fighting, we return fighting."
This is the atmosphere going into that period, 1919, 1920, 1921. This is sort of what the country has been marinating in, for lack of a better word.
Yes, yes, yes. So coming out of the Civil War, following the period of Reconstruction, black people are building black towns across the country. They're building black wealth. They're building universities. They're also building capital power and voting power. And as a result of that voting power, there's a huge backlash against them. You start seeing Jim Crow laws, segregation. The number of lynchings increases during this period. There was this real move, this drive to exterminate black people, to clear out their communities, to stop their economic progress, to wipe them out.
Do you see any parallels or historical lessons for the modern observer? Given the last year, we've had a lot of protests over racism more broadly.
Yes. So this was a period of history that was kept out of textbooks, was whitewashed out of American history. But it happened. I mean, hundreds, perhaps thousands of black people were killed. There is a direct parallel between that period with what is happening now in this country. There was great economic progress, voting progress. The country saw its first Black president. And then you have this backlash, which was very similar to the backlash that occurred around the turn of the century during this Red Summer period. And in order to understand what's happening now with police brutality, what's happening now with the racial tensions, you have to understand Red Summer. You have to understand what happened during the 1921 Tulsa race massacre. The fires that burned, destroying Black Wall Street, still burn today.
Deneen Brown has been writing about this for The Washington Post. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
60 miles away, they had the Tulsa riots years before I was born. But they never talked about them.
Never?
Slaughter. It was a slaughter. They never talked about it. The old folks never talked about it when I was in Oklahoma.
Wow.
I heard a rumor about it. I didn't know what to think.
Over the past week, you have probably heard a lot about the Tulsa race massacre, when a white mob killed hundreds of Black residents in the Greenwood neighborhood on May 31st, 1921. Well, as the 100th anniversary commemorations wind down, we are taking a moment today to look at the Greenwood of 2021. Karen Grigsby Bates from NPR's Code Switch podcast traveled to Tulsa, and she's here with us now. Hey, Karen.
Hi there.
So as you were talking with residents about their thoughts on this anniversary, all the attention generated by this anniversary, what kind of things were you hearing?
Well, people were conflicted. Many acknowledged that more people knowing about this history, Mary Louise, is a good thing, and it's important. But they also worry that the attention generated around this anniversary has just prompted another wave that's pushing historic Black residents to the margins. Here's one example. Tori Tyson owns a hair salon, Blowout Hair Studio. It was located in historic Greenwood for decades until the rent got too high and Tori was forced to relocate to the edge of town a couple of months ago.
I might tell you without crying. Yeah, it was hard. It was hard leaving Greenwood. My family, the customers, the history.
Tori's grandfather had worked in a hotel in Greenwood before the massacre. Her grandmother had owned a hamburger restaurant that got burned to the ground. And now, all these years later, she feels like she's being pushed out again, not by brute force, but by an untenable economic situation.
Hmm. Is this gentrification? That's what's going on here? Businesses that have been there for forever are getting pushed out?
It's definitely part of the problem. Businesses from downtown Tulsa have been pushing towards Greenwood for years. 100 years ago, you had train tracks that divided Black and white Tulsa. Those tracks are still there, but Greenwood's also been chopped up by urban development, you know, highways that go back and forth, which means even more Black families have lost homes and businesses.
I feel like it's gone. Yeah, I feel like it's gone.
That's Nehemiah Frank, the owner, publisher, and editor-in-chief of the Black Wall Street Times, a digital newspaper that takes a critical look at Greenwood's equity issues. Nehemiah says his family owned real estate on Black Wall Street, but after the massacre, many of the families that wanted to stay in Greenwood couldn't rebuild their homes there because the city passed new safety and zoning laws that purposefully made rebuilding there prohibitively expensive.
I like to call it the dry massacre, right? Without the bullets and the bombs and the mob. It was a massacre by, you know, legislation. That's what that was.
So now Nehemiah thinks the only way to make things right by Tulsa's Black community would be for the city to offer up some form of reparations.
It's interesting because the conversation over reparations is obviously unfolding all over the country at this point. Is it realistically on the table in Tulsa?
Well, Mary Louise, when I was in Tulsa, I sat down with its Republican mayor, G.T. Bynum, whose roots in the area go really deep. His great-grandfather on his dad's side was Tulsa's second mayor back in 1899. I asked Mayor Bynum about his take on the idea that Nehemiah brought up, you know, that some families want to be paid for what they've lost.
If the context is around cash payments, well, where does that come from? And the idea of financially penalizing this generation of Tulsans for something criminals did 100 years ago, that's a hard thing to ask.
That sounds pretty close to a no from the mayor on reparations.
It does.
What options does he want to look at?
Well, Mayor Bynum says there are other resources in development coming to the community that he thinks could help change Tulsa and everyone who comes to visit, like a new museum slated to open soon called Greenwood Rising. Lots of money has been poured into its creation with the goal of educating the public about the Tulsa massacre and creating racial healing.
Okay, so a museum, education. How does that take sit with longtime residents of Greenwood that you were meeting, Karen?
Well, here's one. Michelle Brown Burdick. She's the program coordinator for the Greenwood Cultural Center. And the center's been preserving the history of the massacre in the Greenwood community for several decades now. Michelle summarized the concerns of Black Tulsans this way.
There is so much interest in the Greenwood District and in telling the story now that there seems to be a way to capitalize on it, to commercialize it, and that is disrespectful. We are hoping that all of the financial investment into telling the story, promoting the history, investing in organizations, that this continues after the spotlight is no longer on Tulsa.
Yeah, it's the question of what happens, Karen, when national attention shifts away again and you and I aren't on NPR talking about Greenwood, but Greenwood's still there and the people who call it home are still trying to figure out how to make life better there.
And they're going to be doing that for a while.
Karen Grigsby Bates, thanks so much for sharing some of your reporting from Tulsa.
Thanks for having me.
Outdoors, we knew, was a real terror of life. The threat of being outdoors surfaced frequently in those days. Every possibility of excess was curtailed with it. If somebody ate too much, he could end up outdoors. If somebody used too much coal, he could end up outdoors. People could gamble themselves outdoors, drink themselves outdoors. Sometimes, mothers put their sons outdoors, and when that happened, regardless of what the son had done, all sympathy was with him. He was outdoors, and his own flesh had done it. To be put outdoors by a landlord was one thing, unfortunate, but an aspect of life over which you had no control, since you couldn't control your income. But to be slack enough to put oneself outdoors, or heartless enough to put one's own kin outdoors, that was criminal.
In this late phase of the pandemic, it's getting more likely that people will be evicted from their homes if they haven't made the payments. All kinds of people are being evicted, but some new research in Georgia finds that Black Americans are being evicted more often than white Americans. NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
Katrina Chisholm has rented a house outside Atlanta for 3 years. She's a single mom with a teenage son. She lost her customer service job during the pandemic. And back in January, she fell a month behind on the rent.
I remember going to the door and the sheriff standing there, and it scared me because I didn't know why he was at my house.
The reason was her landlord had filed an eviction case against her. Chisholm says she scrambled, managed to find a temporary job, and caught up on the rent.
I worked my butt off. And I borrowed money and I saved everything that I could.
But when that temporary job ended, she fell behind again. Chisholm applied for federal rental assistance money and she got it. But she and her lawyer say her landlord refused to take that money. The landlord disputes that. She says the company told her that her lease was about to end and she had to leave or get evicted.
Once you get that eviction, no one's going to want you to rent from them. So me and my son will be, I want to be in a homeless situation.
Getting evicted can send people into a downward financial spiral. During the pandemic, there's been the added danger of catching or spreading COVID. Chisholm's landlord is a company owned by a private equity investment firm called Pretium Partners, which apparently has been filing eviction cases against a lot of people during the pandemic.
The company has filed to evict more than 1,000 residents since last September.
That's Jim Baker with the Private Equity Stakeholder Project. It's a nonprofit group that's been tracking eviction filings by big corporate landlords. And it's done a report on Pretium finding a racial disparity.
They're filing to evict residents at rates 4 times as high in majority Black counties.
Baker's group looked at four counties where Pretium owns hundreds of rental homes in each and compared two mostly black counties in Georgia with two mostly white counties in Florida. The median income in the counties is similar, but the report found that in the white counties, Pretium's been filing for eviction against about 2% of the people renting those homes.
By comparison, they filed to evict 10 to 12% of their residents in majority black counties in Georgia.
10 to 12% of the people living in their properties in those counties in Georgia?
Yeah, since the beginning of the year. So it's incredibly disturbing.
Pretium declined an interview, but said in a statement that the report is misleading and makes, quote, baseless assertions. The company says it's hired extra staff during the pandemic to work with residents to avoid eviction. It says it's waived millions of dollars in late rent and secured more than $10 million in government rental assistance money for residents. To be clear, the report does not allege any discriminatory intent on the part of the company.
There's nothing here about racial disparities in eviction that I find surprising.
Peter Hepburn is a researcher with the Eviction Lab at Princeton University. He's read the report and says that the disparate impact on black renters goes far beyond any one company. He recently published a study looking at millions of court records of eviction cases across 39 states. This goes back before the pandemic.
Nationwide, on average, we're seeing eviction filing rates against black renters that are about twice as high as what we see for white renters.
Why is that? Hepburn says there's a bunch of reasons.
And some of them are just economic, right? We know that black renters have lower incomes. They have less stable employment as well. They have less in savings, and they're less able to call on family ties to provide financial support in the event of an emergency.
But Hepburn says all that still doesn't explain the whole story, why there would be such a striking difference, twice the eviction rate nationally.
I think there's reason to suspect that landlords may be quicker to file for eviction against a black tenant who's fallen behind on rent than a white tenant.
It's unclear why the report on Pretium's eviction filings apparently found an even greater disparity. Pretium says it provides, quote, equal rental opportunities and support to all our residents. The company says it does not track the race, gender, or ethnicity of residents. Still, Jim Baker says the company appears to have the resources to have been a lot more flexible with renters during the pandemic.
Pretium Partners is not a mom-and-pop landlord. They have billions of dollars in assets under management. They're run by a guy named Don Mullen, who used to work for Goldman Sachs, and he just bought a $20 million mansion in Miami.
Baker says Pretium owns 55,000 rental homes across the country. He says his group looked at other big corporate landlords, too.
We've actually found that there are some quite large landlords that have held off on evicting residents.
Since September, an order from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is aimed to stop many evictions, but renters have to know about it and take steps to be protected. Pretium says it's complying with the CDC rules. In Katrina Chisholm's case, the company offered to forgive the back rent and fees that she owed, but only if she and her son moved out right away.
Yes, it's been extremely exhausting. I literally have things thrown in boxes.
We reached Chisholm on her cell phone as she was moving. She managed to find a place to rent, but it's $400 more a month. And to get it, she and her 16-year-old son had to move in with her boyfriend since she hasn't been able to find a job yet. And the house is an hour away, so her son has to switch schools.
He just gave me that look like, Mom, really? Now I gotta stop and start all over again.
Chisholm says she is glad that the company says it will dismiss her eviction case. Meanwhile, Jim Baker says Pretium has been filing more eviction cases since his report. He says it's now filed to evict nearly 20% of its residents in those mostly black counties in Georgia. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
I say that there can't be racism, white supremacy without mass murder. Killing, like the majority of people that are being killed on the planet are non-white people, and they're all being killed by weapons manufactured by people who classify themselves as white. In a global system of racism, white supremacy. See, where the gun is considered, you've got a problem, then get the gun. You got a problem, too many people of color, get the gun and start killing tens of thousands. Set up situations where you are justified in killing, which is, you know, parallel to stand your ground. If you're afraid, you're justified in killing the black person. You thought they had a weapon. They didn't have a weapon, but you thought they had a weapon. So you're justified in killing them. This is what the entire culture has to look comprehensively at itself.
2020 was the biggest year ever for gun sales in the United States. Some 20 million guns were purchased legally, and some firearms industry estimates say as many as 40% of the purchasers were buying a gun for the first time. Steve Gutowski is the founder of the publication The Reload, and he's long covered firearm policy and gun culture, and he joins us now. Hello.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It is good to have you. I want to start talking a little bit about this huge growth in gun ownership in this past year. It seems to include many more women, people of color, than in the past. I mean, are you seeing a general trend towards more acceptance of gun ownership among a wider population? Or do you think this was more a one-off during a chaotic, upsetting year?
Yeah, I think it's actually a part of a larger trend. We've seen this going on for over a decade now. Gun owners have become more suburban, they've become less white and less male and younger over that time period. And what you saw last year was just an acceleration of that.
And what was behind it? Is it just the idea that they have the right and they should have a gun, or is something else driving it?
Yeah, well, I think there's actually a number of factors. First, you had the chaos that came along with the coronavirus pandemic and the lockdowns. You had people being released from prison early. You had what happened with George Floyd being killed that led to concern among African Americans for their safety. And then, of course, you saw a lot of racist attacks on Asian Americans that motivated a lot of them to purchase guns as well. And then you also had the rioting across the country in multiple cities, which really pushed a lot more people to buy guns for themselves. You know, on top of all of that, you had the normal motivator for gun surges, which is politics.
I'm curious, is there a common ground? What does your reporting tell you about what gun owners do support when it comes to laws that regulate firearms?
Certainly you do see in polling, generally speaking, a high level of approval for things like, you know, universal background checks. And you'll even generally see a majority of support for things like assault weapons bans. But even, for instance, universal background checks was polled very well. When those are actually put up for a vote, for instance, Maine had a vote ballot initiative on universal background checks a few years ago, and it actually failed. There's oftentimes a disconnect, I think, between public opinion polling and motivated voting. But certainly, I think there are common grounds between gun owners and people who want to, you know, reduce gun crime and gun violence. And oftentimes you'll see some levels of agreement in areas that don't involve restriction of firearm access, but instead focus on violence interruption. Even the president has proposed a great deal of new funding for violence interruption programs, which I think are far less controversial than things like new gun bans, because they focus on trying to zero in on the people who are more likely to commit gun crimes and try to, you know, prevent incidents from escalating into violence.
Looking ahead, as we see, you know, this huge spate in gun violence, where do you think this conversation's headed?
Yeah, I think two important things to come for guns in America are, one, whether or not this murder spike that we've seen over the last year and a half or so continues to pick up steam and we get back to the violence levels we had in the 1990s, because we're still, even with this spike, we're still at near historic lows when it comes to gun violence and murder in the United States. But if it continues on, that obviously could change the conversation around guns in America. At the same time, all those new gun owners, especially ones from traditionally Democratic demographics, like who vote for Democrats, how they progress in their gun ownership is going to make a big difference, I think, 5-10 years down the line on how not just the Republican Party deals with guns, but how the Democratic Party deals with it. If they become less willing to vote for politicians who advocate stricter gun laws, you could see the Democratic Party adapt to that new reality and move back towards the center on the issue.
Stephen Gutowski, he's the founder of the publication The Reload. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
So, you know, these events that keep coming up, instead of just reacting, dealing with it one at a time and being shocked each time we have another event that surfaces that is brought to our attention, we need to function from the position of an analysis that clarifies we are in a total system structure of racism, white supremacy, and that is why we are seeing the kinds of behaviors from individuals, be it Donald Sterling or be it George Zimmerman or any of the other cases that come to our attention. There is a reason that these cases exist. And I want to also talk about, in this case, they talked about mental health, but also gun control. And we have to begin to understand, I say you can't understand the gun mania if you don't understand racism, white supremacy. The gun is the answer to conscious and or subconscious, the answer, the response to the quite collective feeling they can be genetically annihilated by black genetic material. And the gun is a great equalizer. I encourage everybody to get a copy of the ISIS papers and read.
In West Virginia, those who get vaccinated could win some major prizes, like a chance to win a college scholarship or a new pickup truck. It's part of a new push from the state to get more shots in arms. Right now, 41% of residents there are fully vaccinated, and 51% have had at least one dose. NBC News reporter Gary Grumbach joins us now from Berkeley Springs, West Virginia. So, Gary, what are you learning about this new incentive plan to help get more people vaccinated? We mentioned some of the prizes. What else can folks win?
Yeah, good morning, Joe. You know, you've heard of those more typical incentives, things like college scholarships or $1 million. That's happening here in West Virginia, too, starting on June 20th. But there's also some things that officials tell me they hope it to be a wild and wonderful twist to the vaccine incentive program here in West Virginia. Of course, hunting and fishing is big business. It's a big hobby here in the state. And so officials are taking advantage of that. They're giving away lifetime memberships, lifetime licenses to the fishing and hunting clubs. They're also doing things like giving away a Ford F-150 trucks, as you mentioned, every week for 5 weeks starting at the end of June. And they're also doing something that's a little more controversial. They're giving away 5 shotguns and 5 hunting rifles as well, just for the fully vaccinated or even partially vaccinated. All they need to do is just get at least 1 shot. Now, organizations like Moms Demand in Every Town, they tell me they're not sure why there's a little bit of a back and forth between a deadly weapon being given for a life-saving vaccine. But that is whatever the officials say, that they think they know their audience and that's what people want. We're here in Berkeley Springs State Park. This is one of the incentives as well. You could get a weekend getaway to one of the 30 state parks across West Virginia as well. So officials are just hoping people get their vaccine for whatever the reason may be.
Now, Gary, West Virginia was one of the first states to offer an incentive for vaccination, a $100 savings bond. We remember early on, West Virginia was really one of the leading states in getting folks vaccinated using their local pharmacies. So why does the state feel like they need to do more now?
Yeah, you mentioned it. It's the low vaccination rate here in West Virginia. It's about 41% is fully vaccinated. That's a lot lower than a number of states around the country. And there's also a new morning consult poll out in May that said that 28% are simply unwilling to get the vaccine. And they're telling a pollster that they're unwilling to get the vaccine. And that's something that officials are really trying to change. It doesn't matter, they say, why you're getting the vaccine, just that you do it. Joe?
All right. Gary, thank you so much.
After a mob stormed the United States Capitol in January, many of the digital spaces where the far right gather, places like the social media site Parler, went dark. Certain Facebook pages were deleted, but one website tailored to far-right paramilitary groups has remained active. Odette Youssef of our member station WBEZ reports.
To some observers, January's insurrection at the Capitol may have looked like a failure. The mob did not stop the certification of votes, and now hundreds are facing criminal charges. But if you went online to see what people were saying on a site called My Militia, you might have concluded the opposite. There, it was all gloating and further calls to violence.
Within that bubble, they haven't really gotten that message.
That's Alex Friedfeld, an investigative researcher who monitors extremism for the Anti-Defamation League. And one of the primary spaces he monitors is My Militia. My Militia has been compared to the dating app Tinder because it helps users browse and join or form unlawful militia groups. The website has about 30,000 users. And Friedfeld says it marks a new phase in America's tradition of anti-government paramilitary organizing.
It used to be that if you wanted to join a militia, it was a difficult process, right? You had to actually really work for it. And now it's a matter of a few clicks. You can be linked up with people in your area who share the same mentality. And My Militia has really led that explosion.
While some of these groups call themselves militia, constitutional experts say that's a misnomer, that the only legal militia in the U.S. is the National Guard. Most of the people who attacked the Capitol were not part of any self-styled militia. Still, these groups are growing and spreading, and the interest has been reflected in My Militia's explosion this past year. That's how long it's been run by Joshua Ellis.
I own a water damage and mold remediation company. We do remodeling, handyman work, all kinds of stuff.
Ellis is 41 and lives in suburban Chicago. He has a long history of not paying taxes and has filed for Chapter 7 bankruptcy protection at least three times. He also calls himself an Army veteran. In fact, he was an Iowa National Guardsman for 6 months and left before he finished advanced training. Ellis didn't create My Militia. A website developer in Ohio did and gave it to Ellis last year. At the time, Ellis was getting some attention for organizing anti-lockdown protests in several states. He claims he used to be with a private paramilitary group in Illinois, but left. And he actually said he doesn't see any point to joining a group now.
Militias have been regulated into being nothing more than prepper groups. They practice camping and starting fires and stuff like that.
But online, it's different. He urges everybody to join a group. Ellis characterizes his site as simply a forum for free speech, and says its moderators keep it clean of calls to violence. And he rejects the claim that it further radicalizes people. He notes that so far, nobody charged in relation to the insurrection has a known connection to My Militia. Nonetheless, the insurrection did have consequences for him.
Is this site generating money?
It used to. It used to, until cancel culture got a hold of it.
Google stopped placing ads on My Militia after January 6th. A spokesperson says the site violated Google's, quote, policy against inciting hatred and violence. For activists on the left who've been organizing to disrupt My Militia's operations, that news was both encouraging and frustrating.
Well, it would have been nice if that would have happened before the attempted putsch, but, you know, bygones are bygones, I suppose.
Talia Lavin has organized social media campaigns to try to take My Militia offline. She also writes about right-wing militant groups. For her, the urgency behind taking down My Militia comes from seeing how the rhetoric on the site around a, quote, stolen election has not cooled.
The genie, once out of the bottle, is very difficult to put back in. And it would be really great if the several tech companies with the power to take My Militia offline today actually acted and exercised their power to do so.
Ellis says he has been dropped by other services like PayPal, Zelle, and Venmo. And so he claims he's now building a competitor, a fundraising site where extremist causes can pull in donations. For NPR News, I'm Odette Youssef.
the man-not, race, class, genre, and the dilemmas of black manhood.
Five Democrats are competing to win the party's nomination for governor of Virginia. One of those candidates is Virginia's lieutenant governor, Justin Fairfax. In 2019, two women accused him of sexual assault. But those accusations, which Fairfax has repeatedly denied, haven't forced him out of office or out of the race for governor. Here's Ben Pavier from member station VPM in Richmond.
2 years after two women came forward to accuse him of sexual assault, Virginia Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax maintains his innocence.
It is an incredible miscarriage of justice to falsely accuse someone of these types of crimes and there be no accountability.
In 2019, Fairfax ordered and passed two polygraph tests. His legal team has pointed out what they say are inconsistencies in his accusers' stories. Fairfax has also connected the allegations against him to larger injustices against black men. Here he is on the debate stage last month, laying into the frontrunner in the race, former Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe.
He treated me like George Floyd. He treated me like Emmett Till. No due process. Immediately assumed my guilt.
And some of his supporters agree.
People really get intimidated when you can articulate and move forward and make things happen.
Tommy Bennett is a Democratic Party activist in Danville, a small southern Virginia city. Bennett says the lieutenant governor was targeted by his political enemies because he's a black man on the rise.
He sort of sounded like Barack Obama when he started.
But the lieutenant governor hasn't raised much money, and he trails McAuliffe, the leading Democrat, by some 40 points. That hasn't dissuaded Bennett.
He still can pull it off.
Even if the accusations from February 2019 are hanging over his campaign. That's when the two black women came forward. Vanessa Tyson accused Fairfax of sexually assaulting her in 2004. 2 days later, Meredith Watson accused Fairfax of raping her in 2000 while they were students at Duke University. The lieutenant governor says the encounters were consensual and repeatedly called for investigations by law enforcement. And he says the accusations are politically motivated.
It becomes a complete injustice and one that mirrors a history of racial injustice.
Neither Tyson nor Watson agreed to comment for this story. Fairfax says their refusal to publicly respond to his rebuttals undermines their credibility. Deborah Katz, an attorney representing Tyson, says her client stands by her claims. She says Fairfax is trying to intimidate his accusers.
The fact that Justin Fairfax is still here seems to be exactly what politicians are doing these days.
Katz has represented women involved in high-profile sexual misconduct accusations, including ones involving Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh and New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. She says they represent a troubling trend in the Me Too movement.
Act completely indignant, never apologize, cede no ground. And to the extent that there is an apology, as in the case of Cuomo, it's I'm sorry you felt bad.
Katz says the Me Too movement scored some important victories.
And yet we're in a pandemic now. Priorities have shifted and there's less of an urgency, it seems.
Still, in Virginia, many Democrats keep Justin Fairfax at arm's length.
A lot of people think if you ignore Justin, then he'll just go away.
Adele McClure is Fairfax's former policy director.
And trust me, like I definitely hoped that that was the case, so I wouldn't have to be speaking to you right now.
McClure now serves as director of Virginia's Legislative Black Caucus. She says she's speaking out because she's worried Fairfax uses his public office to bully his accusers.
He can't wait to get to that governor's office because not only does he feel entitled to it, but he knows that he can wield even greater power over those who spoke against him.
Fairfax, through an attorney, alleged to NPR that McClure is speaking out because she's supporting a different candidate. McClure hasn't made any public endorsements. She says before she resigned as Fairfax's policy director, she wanted to believe in a man she once considered a friend.
I put everything into defending Justin and stood by loyally and just felt completely betrayed.
McClure says she began to lose faith in Fairfax after Tyson released a statement. McClure found it compelling and alleges other staff worked to undermine Tyson.
And they were desperately throughout the week trying to catch her in a lie to discredit her.
McClure alleges they considered a plan that called for using black women and anonymous social media accounts to question Tyson's credibility.
I was just like, no, we cannot attack We can't attack her.
McClure says she thought the plan was later dropped. Fairfax did not respond to NPR's questions about McClure's account. His former chief of staff, Larry Roberts, said he did not recall those conversations and would not have backed that kind of plan. Fairfax has used Twitter to call out the women by name, labeling them false accusers. Deborah Katz, the attorney who represents Tyson, says others have seemed to follow Fairfax's lead. She's noticed a handful of anonymous accounts that attack the lieutenant governor's critics. NPR has not confirmed who is behind the accounts.
I believe that this is a weaponized use of Twitter and social media, and I believe it's part of coordinated campaigns, and it does have a chilling effect on women.
And we are going to win and win big in 2021 with your help. Thank you all so much. God bless you all.
Fairfax has had a busy spring. He's crisscrossed the state in a low-key, low-budget campaign focused on education and racial justice. Still, the accusations are on voters' minds. Monica Hutchinson is a Democratic Party activist who lives outside of Richmond. She says whether the accusations against Fairfax are true or not,
we cannot have anybody be the head of our state with anything, with any dark cloud like that hanging over their head.
Instead, Hutchinson is backing State Senator Jennifer McClellan. McClellan and another candidate, Jennifer Carroll Foy, are running to become the first Black woman elected governor in the U.S. Hutchinson says Black women are ready for a change.
Every single election we show up. But when it's time to pay it back, to let Black women lead, there's always a but. And Black women are tired of it.
It's not clear what Fairfax will do if he loses the primary. Either way, he says he plans on continuing a career in public service. For NPR News, I'm Ben Pavier in Richmond.
Every nigga is a star. Every nigga is a star. Who will deny that you and I and every nigga is a star?
We start tonight at 6 with claims of an attack while on the road. Gastonia police investigating road rage involving two drivers on Franklin Boulevard.
One driver claims he was pepper sprayed and his windshield was damaged. WCNC Charlotte's Brandon Goldner has more on why both drivers claim they're the victim and the other was the aggressor.
Gastonia police tell us they presented this case to a magistrate who ultimately decided not to file any charges in the case. Only one of the two drivers agreed to talk to us on camera, and he tells me he felt his life was in danger. Twavion Graham says this incident started at East Franklin Boulevard and Cox Road. He says the pickup driver in front of him was driving slow, so he went around him. But he says the pickup driver then sped up.
And I'm looking over and he's like flipping me off, calling me the N-word, all this. And I'm looking like...
He claims the driver followed him for 5 miles to the other side of Gastonia.
And he's like rolled down all his windows, pepper spraying my car, trying to hit my car, like trying to run me off the road.
Graham says at one point he stops and gets out of his car.
And I'm like, what did I do? And at that point he tries to hit me with his car. So I have to jump back in my car and he hits the door.
Graham says he began following the driver to get a photo of his license plate. He claims the pickup driver then stopped, got out of his car, began pepper spraying Graham, and then grabbed bolt cutters.
And starts charging at my car, like swinging, trying to hit the windshield and everything. So I have to swerve away from him, and he hits the side of my car.
He says all of this happened while he was on the phone with his mother.
She's screaming, like she's... yelling, cussing. It seemed like something out of a movie. Like, you wouldn't think somebody would really be doing this, but sure enough.
We found the driver of that pickup truck. He refused to talk to us on camera, saying his lawyer advised him not to talk. He indicated he was the victim and claimed an arrest warrant was filed against Graham. However, Gastonia police tell us they presented both drivers' stories to a magistrate who ultimately decided not to charge anyone. We asked the other driver if we could speak to his attorney, but he refused to give us his attorney's name. At Gastonia Police Headquarters, Brandon Goldner, WCNC Charlotte.
Context of white supremacy. I'll do our proper introduction and all that good stuff in a moment. We've had many instances over the past 17 months or so now, really, you know, throughout the history of racism, white supremacy. Remember James Craig Anderson? I almost used that sound clip. 2011. The reason I didn't, James Craig Anderson wasn't in a vehicle. This wasn't a road rage thing. They just decided, hey, nothing to do on a Friday night in Mississippi. Want to go kill a Negro? Let's go kill a Negro. All right. First Negro we happen to see, James Craig Anderson, killed that Negro. And then went and bragged about it. Ran that Negro over. Daryl Deadman in prison right now, we hope. So I almost played that one. No black person, particularly in the U.S., but really anywhere in the known universe, no black person should be saying, like, oh my goodness, I can't believe it. It looks like this white person might be trying to run me off the road or run me over with his car. Like, I can't believe this is really happening. This happens every day. They don't make movies about this enough in terms of the frequency in which this happens in real life. And it's been escalating over the past, as I said, in my view, year and a half, all the wackiness with the Rona situation. We've had a ton of them. I think Irie, she told us about the situation in her part of the plantation, Louisiana, where it was a black mother with her child in a stroller. And the white people were revving the gas. Run that Negro over and her child. Run them both over. So I say all that to say, hey, if you pay attention to the news at all, again, for the folks who say, checking the news is silly, that's a waste of time, they just lie, don't waste your time reading the news, that is dangerous and idiotic thinking. It's not logical at all. It doesn't make sense. If you check the news, you will see these type of reports all the time. When I mean all the time, like weekly. Sometimes you'll see several instances like this, and all over the country. Black person ran off the road. Black child ran off the road. They had the one that was a non-white person. They slung acid at her. And I mean, just regular occurrence. Now, all of that said, this incident in Gastonia, no charges filed. So, you know, but at least in my view, going from what the victim shared, the black male victim of white supremacy, you see all of this happen. He said the person was driving slow. He went to get around them, and then the terrorism begins, yelling, cursing, trying to pepper spray the vehicle, and all the rest of it. What I have encouraged, distance. At this point, you are not trying to follow, you're not trying to yell back at the person, you're not trying to curse them out. You want a distance. Take, if you're on like the freeway or whatever, next exit. Regardless of where you're going, you can get off and then get right back on or whatever, but distance. I think that's what they teach you in defensive driving school. They don't teach you to follow the person and curse them out. Not distance. Let them get on down the road. They will have another, you know, incident like that probably if they keep continue in that manner, and or enforcement officials hopefully will spot them and snatch their license or whatever. But you don't want to follow. So he says he follows and is trying to get a picture, which I can see some logic to that, but man, distance. Just look, license, and distance. Get away, slow down, get away, get away, get away. Now, he says he pursues, and the person is doing all this, and he gets out of the car. We heard that before, the fella in Seattle. I don't think he was in Seattle. I think he was in, like, Tacoma. Close enough, Seattle area. This year, this is just a few weeks ago, like I said, reading the paper. This black fella, he was delivering newspapers on his job. A white person who happened to be an off-duty enforcement official is following him. He did the same thing. He sees this guy following him. He hops out of the vehicle. What's going on? He goes up to him. In fact, if I remember it correctly, he goes up to the vehicle. What's going on, man? Why are you following me? And I said then, that is a terrible decision. He could have died on the spot right there. Bam. Pull out my gun. Shoot him. I'm an enforcement official. Thought he had a gun. He came up aggressively to the vehicle, which I'm sure he probably had his camera and all the rest. He came up aggressive to the vehicle, looked like he had crack cocaine in his mouth, and had to shoot him 18 times. Get a promotion, probably. Put his face on the state flag in Washington here. When these situations, I don't care if it's a white person or a non-white person, do not pursue. You certainly are not doing anything that might escalate, or I'm trying to challenge this person, or who do you think you are, and trying to run me off the road, and all of that, totally wrong. Get to a public place with lots of people. If it's a grocery store, I was going to say Waffle House, but it seems like they brutalize a lot of black people there, but a mall, someplace public, lots of people, cameras. People tend to calm themselves a little bit when it's a big likelihood that, this might be on camera and police might get here really quick if I cut a fool here, as opposed to we're out on the road and, you know, I can do whatever and shout and try and run you off the road or kill you and then just flee really quick, as opposed to you don't have to get a picture of his license plate because they got cameras there. They'll have a picture of him, the car, license plate, everything. People tend to behave a little differently, not always, but at least they become cognizant, like, ooh, they're going to be witnesses for what happens here, and probably video. So those are the two major takeaways. All those reports about new gun owners, I suspect this is what I've been saying. When we conclude the program and say, hey, these type of incidents with a stranger in public, white or non-white, I think this is a white person, hey, you should be thinking, this fella may have more than pepper spray. Same thing I said. You don't hop out of that vehicle just, I'm going to yell at you. What if he does have more than pepper spray? I mean, he's got the vehicle. That's enough right there. Why am I hopping out of the vehicle? I apparently did not leave with a code to kill or die in counter-racist violence. Apparently, I didn't have that code. Most of us don't leave the house with that sort of code. No problem. Distance. Very increasingly dangerous times, particularly in the U.S., where we have lots and lots of new gun owners, in addition to the millions of gun owners that we had anyway. Now we can do proper introduction, compensatory call-in, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information like that on the system of racism, white supremacy, what it is, how it works, what it means to be classified as white, and what non-white people victims of racism should be doing to help solve this problem immediately. Today's date, Saturday, June 5, 2021, so I have been told. New book. I am excited for the book club. Not that I wasn't excited for Geronimo Pratt, but we just read O.J. Simpson, and you know, that's all that is. And I had already read Geronimo Pratt, Last Man Standing, so it's a little challenging to be super excited about a book that you've already read, and then I had to narrate. You all, anyone who's listened to The Cows for any period of time knows I loathe narrating, so it's difficult for me to be super excited, but we're done. I learned a lot, very constructive. COINTELPRO, wow. And we got such beautiful sequencing. We ended with O.J. Simpson. They did all that complaining about Johnny Cochran and wanting to fire him from the Pratt team because he got O.J. Simpson off and wears all those flashy suits and all the rest of it. They mentioned Tupac Shakur, Geronimo Pratt, Tupac Shakur's godfather, COINTELPRO, Tupac Shakur, a victim. Apparently, Notorious B.I.G. may have been a victim as well. But that is why I said, I think, 3-4 weeks into us reading O.J. Simpson, Run of His Life, I said the master class on this would be Orenthal James Simpson, beating of Rodney King and the subsequent trial, unrest, whatever you want to call it, rioting. O.J. Simpson, the murder and trial. Assassination of Tupac Shakur, which was in Las Vegas, and the assassination of Notorious B.I.G., which was in Los Angeles. All of that should be looked at together. And the Rampart scandal, I forgot that was the other part, which is a major component of the book we are about to read. All of that should be looked at together. Johnny Cochran, even when they got Geronimo Pratt released, he mentioned he was talking about Rampart in the middle. Remember I said Amy Goodman? She was talking and she said, oh yeah, Johnny Cochran, who's most known for getting O.J. Simpson off and represented Geronimo Pratt for a quarter century. And oh, by the way, is now representing Sean Combs. Said, oh my goodness, that's, got to put them all together. So we will be reading Labyrinth by Robert Sullivan on the assassination of Tupac Shakur, Notorious B.I.G., and the corrupt Los Angeles Police Department, Mark Furman et al. So if you have paid it, or even if you haven't, it's in the archives. So you can just go back at your leisure and or just read the two books that we just read. Jeffrey Toobin, Run of His Life, Geronimo Pratt, Last Man Standing, and now Robert Sullivan, Labyrinth. I'm excited. And be thinking, like, because I don't think most people would think, like, what do all of those cases have to do with each other? Other than the loose connection to Los Angeles. Again, Tupac Shakur's assassination was not in Los Angeles. So what do all of these events have to do with each other? Other than they're in Los Angeles and the LAPD seems to be involved in all of them. If you connect them all, does that change your opinion about any of these events or the claims about what happened or people's perspective if you link all of these events which happened very close in time in the same geographic location? And some of these people are connected, not 6 degrees of separation here, like 1 degree. I'm excited. Excited. That'll be Thursday. Book club reading is more important than watching television, and I don't have to narrate, so I am gleefully excited headed into the summertime. Next, lengthy list. I am so tired of hearing about Tulsa, Oklahoma. I watched some of the documentary, the PBS documentary. They had like 50 of those just to be on my doing my counter-racist homework or attempting to do so. I watched, I think, half of the PBS documentary. I would have to watch the rest of it to make an assessment, but I'm kind of tired of hearing about all of that. I'm of the opinion, kind of the same way that I felt about the mention of the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, that it was done in kind of a superficial manner, in a way that generally supported white supremacy racism in the manner in which it was discussed. I would say that mostly about the Tulsa situation as well. And in fact, one thing I wanted to point out, the clip that we heard last week, the photographic history of the Tulsa massacre, Carlos Hill, who is a victim of racism, VGQ, Victims Guaranteed Qualified, but he asserted that the folks, black people in Tulsa, that they were resilient and that they bounced back and that Tulsa was thriving and in a so-called renaissance within, you know, a few decades of the massacre. And I think myself and some of the other listeners who dialed in last week said VGQ, but that does not seem logical, especially if the victims are not compensated and people lost businesses and they didn't receive anything, no recuperation at all. People lost houses, people lost lives. How would that be possible? And then you hear the gentrification, like, come on. Accuracy, that's accuracy. If we're going to talk about these events, at minimum, let's be honest, and particularly with Tulsa, because it's a century of lies saying, you know, it was 5 people died and one of them was a raccoon. And then, oh, it was 300, probably more than that, but I mean baseline minimum, 300 black people that died. Oh, okay. Well, let's be honest about that. Let's not go with that old tired rhetoric line of Negro strength and vitality and, oh, they're so resilient and know how strong the black people are and they just take a licking and keep on. Come on. That's nonsense. Let's see. Next. Do not allow Sesame Street to inform your children about racism, white supremacy. Wow, that segment was an abomination from beginning to end. Like, I've watched Sesame Street. Remember Neil Postman from the book club of people who participated, Stupid Talk, Crazy Talk? We read that before the flood, 2017. And he criticized Sesame Street and saying, people think that Sesame Street is educational, and he says it is not. What it does is teach children that something that's educational had better be entertaining, or I'm not going to pay attention to it. He also talked about O.J. Simpson to Neil Postman, but that's neither here nor there. But he said that about Sesame Street. It's not about education, it's about entertainment. So now they are going to, in an entertaining manner, talk around race. I didn't even hear white supremacy. They were saying like discrimination, and you can tell a 5-year-old about melanin, but not the system of white supremacy, racism. Bert, Ernie, Cookie Monster, all of you, get out of here. Do not rely on Sesame Street or anything else to teach your child about white supremacy racism. That is for sure. Attempted mommy time, attempted daddy time. Use it, or you sit down with your child and watch that rubbish and call it out for what it is. That is racism, white supremacy right there. And what that, look at this. Melanin. This is not about differences and me looking at someone and say, oh, you're different. That's not what this is at all. This is about individuals who classify themselves as white saying, you see that there, son, daughter? That is a Negro. Let me learn you about the Negro. That's what this is about. Not we see differences and we don't want to talk. Get out of here. White people, we had backstage racism. Dr. Joe Feagin, he was a guest on the program in 2010. What'd he say? It's in the book, in the journal entries. Attempted. It's only one mother, one father on the planet. White mom said, we had to be a little bit more careful with little Johnny. He went to school and was telling racist jokes. And, you know, we had some of the relatives around and they were, you know, talking about Obama and Negro this. And he went back and repeated it. So we got to do a little bit better job and, you know, making sure he's more codified, doesn't go to school just repeating everything. They already know if they're classified as white, like stop. And it was all that presenting as though everybody is prejudiced. We all have our own discrimination and what. Oh, repulsive. Do not rely on Sesame Street. Next. The metaphors were rolling this week, my goodness, especially in the segment with the, I don't know why that was, but the segment with the black farmers and them potentially getting aid and being skeptical, logically so. Wow, the metaphors were just a rolling. I have to save that for when I bring up metaphors, but it was like every other sentence was metaphor, metaphor, metaphor. Let's see. Mr. Fairfax, Lieutenant Governor in Virginia, carry me back to old Virginia. I thought it was, let me think, what would be the correct word? Significant would apply, but something, let me see. I have to think about it. Let me talk for a little while. Maybe I'll come to the correct term. So they did this whole segment, Mr. Fairfax, black male, accused of sexual misconduct, like so many, 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 many others. They did not include that these allegations, unless I missed it, you know, I make errors some days, so I might have missed it, but I didn't hear them mention that, oh yeah, these allegations erupted literally hours after the coon man, Governor Northam, is accused of posing as either a Klan member or in blackface, we don't know which one, but one of the two, and doing all this blackface dancing, and he was about to do the moonwalk, remember that? That was the context of these allegations. It's not like these just popped out, you know, any old time and, oh man, Justin Fairfax, what have you been doing? And blah, blah, blah. No. It was and in fact, that was the charge that some folks labeled like, wow, this seems really suspicious. Like, is this diversionary? Because there was, for that brief period before these charges came out, I think even Mr. Fairfax had said, I think Governor Northam should step down, and he's lieutenant governor. I think he would have been next in line. For a brief period, it was like, oh, wow, Virginia may have its next black governor. It's only been Doug Wilder. That's it. Like, wow, they may have another black. And then, raping black. Never mind. Go on. Stay in there, coon man. Stay in there and pitch. Metaphor. And even there, the metaphors in that segment, they said they charged that it may be that maybe Mr. Fairfax has some staff members who are going online and attacking, whatever that means, attacking some of these folks who are making accusations that Mr. Fairfax engaged in some sort of sexual misconduct, which he may have. I don't know. But they said the folks who I guess are going on Twitter and doing this, if this is happening, they said that it has a chilling effect on people who, I guess, attempt to come forward and speak about what's happening to them. I don't know what that means either. Chilling effect. And then they also like metaphors. And this is one when people point out Mr. Fuller in his word guide where he says, you know, we shouldn't say that it's a black day. And I think at the weather report recently, they say we're not going to say blackout, system outage and that sort of thing. If black is going to always be associated with something vile, something bad, the worst possible event is blackness. Oh, if that's what it's going to be, then yes, that needs to be called out and stopped every time. So in the same segment about the no good raping black male, they say, you know, I supported Lieutenant Governor Fairfax, but we just cannot have someone going to the governor's office with a dark cloud hanging over them. Dark cloud, of course. We can't have that. Another nigger in office and a nigger cloud too. Like, oh yes, yes. Now, I don't know what they mean by dark cloud, but I thought we just had in the same series of clips, they talked about Thomas Jefferson and people maybe rethinking old raping, racist, slave-owning Thomas Jefferson of the same state. Maybe he had a dark cloud over his head too. In fact, I would challenge someone, can you find anyone in a system of white supremacy who they don't have any problems, errors, they've done everything perfectly? Does any such person exist? Same thing I keep coming back to when they talk about when it's a dead Negro, generally someone who's been killed unjustly, Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, he was no angel, you know. He had a dark cloud or two, you know, spot on his record, blemish. All the metaphors, negative, 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 or they, even that one, all the metaphors, something vile in association with black people, blackness. And then they said that Governor or Lieutenant Governor Fairfax has some sort of feeling of entitlement to the governorship. How in the world would any individual classified as black, especially in the Coon Man's Commonwealth, feel a sense of entitlement to the governorship? There's been one black governor in the entire history. We're talking 400 year history of the state of Virginia. They've had one Negro governor. How in the world, when I was born in Virginia, who but black person is thinking, oh yeah, that governor seat is mine? Who is thinking that? Doug Wilder, that's it. And that was 30 years ago. I could be wrong. Maybe he, you know, like I said, it could be that Mr. Fairfax did engage in some sexual misconduct, even though they did say he passed 2 lie detectors, for whatever that's worth. You know, maybe, and maybe he does have a sense of entitlement. Who knows? Next. Let's get to the metaphors. Let's get to the metaphors. Wowee. I've said for about 12 years, I think, context of white supremacy often, our sense of timing has just been amazing. Sometimes I take these as small signals that we might be doing the correct thing, doing what we are supposed to be doing to try to solve this problem. So we read, as mentioned previously, Jeffrey Toobin's run of his life about the O.J. Simpson trial at the beginning of this year. Enthralling, lots of book club participation, amazing, changed my opinion about the whole O.J. Simpson trial, because that was the first time that I seriously analyzed the case. In fact, if you had spoken to me prior to December 2020 and asked, hey Gus, do you know who F. Lee Bailey is? I'd probably had to say no. Didn't watch the Simpson trial, don't know about Sam Shepard and all that, like, no. I don't know who that is. Tell me something about F. Lee Bailey. It's like, you didn't watch the Simpson trial? No, I did not watch the Simpson trial. Tell me something about F. Lee Bailey. Like, you don't remember the whole Mark Furman? No, I do not. Well, I guess I saw it, you know, by osmosis through all these years. But no, I did not sit and watch that. F. Lee Bailey, I have to go and check out this dude. Just in that short period of time, F. Lee Bailey, guest on the program back, I think the day after Christmas, so-called, 2020. And then we spent all that time reading the book and dissecting his examination of Mark Furman on the witness stand, where Mark Furman divulged that he is a high school dropout and attended 3 different community colleges and still didn't graduate. F. Lee Bailey. He passed away this week at the age of 87. When I wrote about that online, I mentioned the great Johnny L. Cochran Jr. did not even live to the age of 70. Geronimo G. Jaga Pratt also did not live to the age of 70. F. Lee Bailey passed away this week, Thursday, day of the book club, in fact, at the age of 87. Not that I think, you know, hey, we would be here for a long time if it was not for the system of white supremacy racism. 87 is not, you know, that big a deal either to me. I'm just pointing that out for the record. Anyway, so O.J. Simpson, everything connects back to O.J. Simpson. So I'm checking the news this week, and even a listener mailed me this one as well. I'm checking the news. President Obama allegedly is quoted in this book, one of his former staff members, and he talks about metaphors all the time. He makes a comparison between Orenthal James Simpson and former President Donald Trump. I'll read the report. It says, Trump is, for a lot of white people, this is a quote allegedly from former President Obama, Trump is, for a lot of white people, what OJ's acquittal was to a lot of black folks. You know it's wrong, but it feels good. Now, all of that is in quotes. Obama allegedly said all this in an undated quote published by the New York Times. Maybe he said it, maybe he didn't, but I mean, wow. This is what I mean about the metaphors, the comparison. There's a reason Gus has requested for years on the compensatory call-in now. Let's not use metaphors for this broadcast specifically. In an effort to, the reason for that is people are frequently very reckless in using metaphors, or even the person who's speaking hasn't really thought about the comparison that they're making. Is this logical? Does this make sense? And sometimes these are subjective. People might not necessarily even understand the metaphor that's being used. Lots of ways that confusion and racism, white supremacy, lots of reasons why we should really make an effort to be explicit with what we're saying. Now, with this metaphor specifically, like, are you kidding me? WTF. Bold face print. Like, Orenthal James Simpson was acquitted in a court of law by a jury of white and non-white people. If they looked at the evidence for 10 months, the longest jury sequestration in history, who is, and matter of fact, President Obama, when he came out and talked about Trayvon Martin, the murder trial, he didn't say, you know, it's wrong and it's messed up and rant. He said, hey, we are a country of laws and the jury has spoken. They reviewed the evidence. The same thing happened in the O.J. Simpson trial, which was much, much longer. You know it's wrong? I don't know if he said it or not. It could have been a white person who lied and said that President Obama said this. So whoever is spewing this language, the New York Times, we talked about that too. We talked about that just yesterday. The New York Times was participating in line during the O.J. Simpson trial on Johnny Cochran as well. Anyway, I don't know who said it, but this is how we talked about the propaganda in terms of why so many black people, non-white people are convinced that O.J. Simpson is guilty. When you have the president coming out and talking this way, when he didn't do that, when it was George Zimmerman, he said, hey, the jury's spoken, the country of laws. Now, he was in office, so maybe he felt he had to be more circumspect, more reserved with his comments, as opposed to now he's out of office. But I mean, hey, this is No Drama Obama. Isn't that his nickname? My memory bad. You could check me on that. No Drama Obama. When has he come out in this manner and questioned the jury? You're telling me a jury, what they said, jury of his peers? You telling me they sat down and got it wrong after 10 months? Get out of here. And what's being compared? White people feeling good about the election of President Trump. Why would white people feel good about electing President Trump. And when they know it's wrong, having this guy be the most powerful person in the free world, as they say, why would they feel good about that? And how does that compare to black people? I mean, O.J. Simpson did not get, you know, you get to be in charge of the state of California now that you're not going to be a convicted murderer. That didn't happen. It appalled me on so many levels, not to mention the greatest of all of this is anyone, if you look at the evidence, man, it is going to be hard to conclude O.J. Simpson killed anybody. I don't know if President Obama watched the trial. I don't even know if he said this or not, but I mean, we read Jeff Toobin's book. He was convinced O.J. was guilty. And reading that book, I am convinced O.J. didn't kill anybody. We have been lied to about many things. The O.J. Simpson trial is one on a long, long, long list. No metaphors. Even President Obama, if he wants to call in, no metaphors. This sort of thing is on a regular basis with the metaphors. If we can be direct, explicit about what it is that we want to say, that would be appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. And again, race soldiers have done things like this for years, making these types of comparison. And this is the type of comparison that almost suggests white people and black people are both racist. He's done this sort of thing a lot. I can't say that. President Obama, way back when he was trying to be president in 2008, when he was saying his grandmother has said racist things, and so has Jeremiah Wright. Everybody is a little racist. That's hogwash, too. If we're going to talk about racism, let's be accurate. But again, the comparisons, analogies, very important. If we could take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, observations, questions, suggestions, that would be great. Make sure everyone gets at least one chance to speak. If you have additional thoughts, you can let everyone get their one turn and then you can share. Also, if you know you are in a noisy environment, if you could please use your mute button. That way we don't have to grapple with a lot of folks who are talking in the background, or if you've got the television or something else playing, get to maybe a quieter area, share your commentary, and then you can mute your line again. And then again, if you want to share again, once everyone's spoken, get to that quiet spot again and unmute. That would be great. Just helps preserve the quality of the program. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. We'll get the first few folks. Just, did you all hear that segment about Nestle acknowledging that most of their products are rubbish, toxic for human consumption? The only thing I was surprised about was the just mammoth amount of products, water and coffee. I mean, it is amazing. Like, I thought they just did like the confectionaries and things, but wow. I think particularly if you eat like a conventional what they call SAD, the standard American diet, like, I think it would be almost impossible for you to even boycott Nestle because they make so many products. Like, you would really have to get back to just fruits, veggies, plant-based diet if you really want to stick it to Nestle, metaphor, as they say, and not support them. But I mean, well, and I knew about their water theft on the planet, but I mean, that together, like, woof. Poisoning us with the food, and then you go around and loot water, particularly in non-white areas, and sell it back to them. Like, Nestle, make you think a whole different way about Nestle Crunches and Butterfingers and all of their toxins that admitted by their own corporation, toxins. 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Let's see. First few folks with a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Robert, in Southern California.
Greetings, rest of the host, listeners, and callers. I'm just getting off of work, so I didn't hear the clips at all. But I did have something that I wanted to share on the broadcast. I am an attempted father. My children are not with me in San Diego, California. They are in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So my 14-year-old daughter just completed the eighth grade. And so she put some photos on Instagram, which I thought were inappropriate. I thought they were inappropriate, not in a major way, but it led me to do some investigating. So when I go in the comment section, as I thought, you know, young males were commenting on how she looked. She's an attractive young female. And then so another female around the same age, she chimed in and stated that my daughter knew where home was. And my daughter's reply was that she does know where home is, and with some wedding ring emojis. So I called my daughter and I asked her flat out if she liked girls. And she was evasive with her answer. And I had her put her mom on the phone. And so come to find out, my daughter does have some interest in females, and they said that they were afraid to tell me because they know my stance on homosexuality, and they, you know, didn't want, you know, me reacting angrily, or I guess showing like any type of resistance to the choice that she feels that she's making on her own. And so my position was, you know, I stated that I don't agree with that behavior. She is my daughter, and I'll always support her. But I'm not in agreement with that lifestyle choice. And I was putting it out on the broadcast because I know that there is other attempted parents on the broadcast. Along with adult black females, and it, you know, finding out hurt my feelings. Also, finding out in the manner that I did hurt my feelings as well. And so, I'm just looking for some kind of feedback if anyone feels that they have something to share. And thank you for listening.
Wow. Much obliged, Rob in Wisconsin. My apologies, sir. Rob in Southern California. Man, I've said also for years, I am not a parent. Man, that is such a hard job. And in a system of white supremacy, that is such a hard job. I just mentioned Sesame Street, that everything is aligned against you as an attempted parent, attempted father, attempted mother, whatever, attempted grandparent, whatever. Everything is aligned against you and trying to do the best that you can for your offspring. Everything. Sesame Street, everything. So everything that you're talking about, all the sexual incorrect behavior, and then posting all of these kind of risque photographs and what have you, that is kind of a core component of white supremacy culture now, right up there with, you know, the guns. You know, we got a lottery to give out guns for the lottery. So it's so much that you have to fight against in the system. And then I'm not a attempted father, but I mean, wow, like to feel like people don't even want to share information with you about your child. This is my attempted daughter, and man, you all are acting like I'm some sort of stranger. Like, oh, we don't want to tell you, and man, all the. I mean, wow. I guess maybe that's black male privilege too. Maybe. If we have other parents, I know I see one. I mentioned Irie in Louisiana already about the road rage situation, where I believe the race soldiers in that situation, after they attacked the attempted parents, they went after her too. But I'd already mentioned her, and she just talked about this, both I think as an educator and an attempted parent, about how rampant this is and how they push all of this in the school. So yeah, I know Irie is here with us as well. If we have other attempted parents, Rob in California is requesting any input, feedback. I think attempted parents would be good, not to spectate on this one. Other folks with a hand up?
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Gus. Hello, everyone on the line. I want to start off with the clip about Naomi Osaka. I just want to say I hope she gets the constructive help that she needs to better cope with her her anguish, her mental anguish as from the system of racism, white supremacy. The segment about Sesame Street, I used to watch it growing up, and I don't remember them taking on topics of racism, white supremacy, or anything to that grand. And I also want to point out, they said they want to talk about melanin, and but aren't all the different characters different colors? And only now they came to the conclusion that I see different colors. It's kind of odd. The next segment about the black farmers. At the beginning of the segment, it said white farmers got full access. And we have these black farmers who are still dealing with different, the same issue. I mean, filing lawsuits, winning them, and then it just repeats itself. It's funny how they could never find a solution for black problems. I also noted in that segment there was a metaphor used referring to speedboats. I thought that was interesting. And I thought the part where, I guess, one of the speakers said that they're making the application process more simpler for applicants. It's just like to me, it's a diss. It's more of an insult. Making it seem like, well, black people are children and we just don't know any better. We're just feeble-minded and can't, you know, fill out an application. The segment about the seminary, again, more tackiness. I thought it was extremely tacky for him to ask for forgiveness in the midst of an interview. And the problems have not been solved yet, and there are still people complaining about them. The segment about the water issue, I will say that clean drinking water is a right for all living creatures. And in my opinion, racists are to never be forgiven for this. The segment about the militia, I believe the guy said that he has not paid taxes in years. And yet the IRS or anyone else is not coming looking for him for their money. You know, no surprise. I think Trump was the same way and countless other, I'm sure of it. I want to report, I think you brought up a lottery for people who have taken the vaccine. We also had our lotteries out here with Gavin Newsom personally picked out, I think, about a couple different winners. And they won money. Totaling $750,000, I believe, and each number he pulled, they won $50,000. And he's going to do this every Friday, I believe he said he's going to do it every Friday. So I thought that was, for people who've gotten the vaccine, and this is like their additional incentive, I guess. And moving on to the next, about the Virginia. Again, I guess I came to the same conclusion that you did, Gus, about just the metaphor. Something in their past, something dark in their past. I thought, you know, the governor, his nickname was the Coon Man. It's just tacky all the way around. But thank you for taking my call, and I mute my line.
Gets no better than tacky. Yes, in that segment on the white websites that are geared towards white militia members who have paramilitary experience, they bragged about not paying taxes. White fella. I was like, man, don't they, Wesley Snipes and all these folks, they go snatch the great Joe Louis. Wait a minute, Negro, we want every nickel. Served him, but I served him. We want every nickel. You're out here fomenting insurrection and bragging about not paying taxes? White power. Now, the metaphor, I didn't even catch the speedboat metaphor in the segment on the farmers, but it was because they had a metaphor, a different metaphor, every other sentence. The speedboat metaphor. Now, they said, I'm just giving the full context, they were talking about the loans. Fewer than 10% of farmers of color could qualify for this because most don't get their loans from the government. Many don't try after the horror stories. That's another metaphor right there. The department is committed. Racist stories, white supremacist incidents. I think they got through this whole incident. Did they say, I'm going to have to check to see if they used the term racism at all in this segment. Anyway, the department is committed to changing the status quo, metaphor, but it won't happen overnight, metaphor, says Dwayne Goldman, a black farmer from Arkansas and the USDA's new racial equity advisor. Dwayne Goldman, this is not a speedboat that we're changing direction. This is a huge barge in a slow-moving stream. It's going to take some time to change course. What in the hell? Are we talking about not practicing racism against black farmers? Or are we out speedboating? Are we fishing? What are we even talking? Let me check right now. Do they use the term racism at all in this report? They talked for almost 5 minutes. The word racism is not used anywhere in this report. We got speedboats. What were some of the other metaphors? If you stick your hand in a hole and a snake bites you once, and you come back and you stick your hand in the hole the second time, and the snake bites you again, what's going to happen the third time you stick it? I mean, every other. Can we speak directly, precisely, about what we're talking about, especially when it's racism, white supremacy, or we just got to use buckets and buckets of words and metaphors and cliches and all the rest of it? Major part of the problem right there. Victims, we have been conditioned to talk in this sort of mealy-mouthed way about racism for years and have been punished for trying to speak accurately about the problem. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, much obliged, sir. Other folks, proceed. Hello. Previously mentioned Irie.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, yes. Hold tap. Hope everybody's doing well. Thank you, Gus, for the show tonight. I didn't catch the headlines, and but I do have something to contribute about Sesame Street. I suspect that race has not been brought up, one, because they didn't want to talk about it. Two, they showcased Miles and his father, who was like a Broadway actor, actually very decorated actor, and his wife, not in real life, but these were both very seasoned Broadway actors. So they had them as a family unit, and they also showcased primarily Maria and I can't remember, Luis. And it's sad that they're the names I remember, but it's because they were the couple that was pushed out, you know, and they could be considered Puerto Rican, Boricua, I don't know, you know, considering that Sesame Street is supposed to be taking place in New York. So I think that's why they didn't talk about racism. And two, I could be incorrect, but being that I have studied creative writing and fiction, I think monsters are assumed to be white. And this is why you can make a non-human entity white by way of the voicing, the choice of voicing in a program, and the eye color. So we would have to go back and look at the eye color of the monsters. For instance, there was another show I was watching where they had non-human entities, which would be considered monsters, but they had blue eyes. So that indicated that they were white people. white adjacent, if that is not a metaphor. As far as the gentleman with the daughter that is experiencing some sexual confusion, yeah, because of the inundation of it in school, in media, you know, kids kind of feeling their way through life, as well. A lot of times I think that some kids develop homosexuality as a form of rejection from the group that they really want to be around or be with. So if your daughter, maybe like me, growing up had some social awkwardness or whatever and didn't really get a lot of attention from males, it could be turning into feelings and thoughts of homosexuality because she isn't getting the reinforcement that she's looking for. That per se didn't happen to me. What happened with me was I didn't get attention from boys because I was book smart and I wasn't, as my grandmother would say, fast. I didn't give sexual access. And because boys didn't visibly chase after me, other females accused me of being gay. And then later on, I remember questioning, am I gay? And then I was upfront with myself and said, I don't like girls. I don't like them like that. They cool, but I could never kiss one, be in love with one. No, I'm not gay. So I was able to answer that question. But I also wasn't a teenager in 2021. You know what I'm saying? This is like 1997, 1998. I would stay in the question lane with her, ask her, what does it mean to be homosexual? Have you been in love with a man or a male? What was that like? Was there abuse? Have you been in love with a female already, not just attracted to her? What is that like? You know, how was that? What was the quality of that relationship? And then I don't know what else to suggest, but, you know, maybe you could talk to a professional, a black female professional, I would think, about how to further go on talking to her. But the last thing you want to do is shut her out, because I have a sister that is also sexually confused. And because my stepmother was physically abusive, she didn't come out for years. And then when she finally came out, they ended up having a fight, a fist fight. Real quick. I wanted to share, I've been busy because I've been helping other black people and trying to replace white supremacy with justice, like in literal ways in the community I'm nested in. And I found myself in a four-wall situation, according to the code, which I don't care for. And I want to extend thanks to retired firefighter for talking to me multiple times about my experience so far. But everything Mr. Fuller said is true about the four-wall method, but I'm hoping that me learning the code and going over it repeatedly, maybe I can instill that in these other non-white people so we can actually get something done productive. And, it's, you know, it starts with codification, but I see that it starts with planning. And there are a lot of people in the area, the people activity of law and education and politics, and they're in it for all the wrong reasons. And I'm just slowly but surely trying to just be constructive. But I see why it hasn't worked, in other words. But this is the last thing I want to share, because this was absolutely, I laughed, but I was pissed off. One of the members asked a white woman, suspected racist, to help put on an expungement class for, obviously, felons, people with other types of legal issues. And so she strayed away from that topic and asked this non-white male, would you please stop telling people not to get vaccinated? And then he said, I don't do that. He said, I just tell people I'm not getting vaccinated, but I don't tell them not to. She said, well, that's still bad enough. She was like, you know, it's the black people that are most at risk for COVID. And I'm just listening, right? So she says, let me tell you something about Tuskegee. It wasn't the fact that they didn't give these men medication. It was the fact that they did. That's what Tuskegee was about. That's when my eyes literally rolled to the back of my head. I said, I cannot take this anymore. I'm going to question lane this white lady back on topic. So I asked the person to give me the phone. I said, ma'am, I'm helping out here. Are you a white person? She goes, yes. I said, okay. I said, have you heard of or read the book Medical Apartheid? She says, oh, yes, I did read that. I read that book. I said, okay, and who's the author? She says, you know, I can't remember right now. Who is the author? I said, ma'am, it's not my place to tell you. You're an attorney. You can find that out on your will and on your time. I said, but I do find it interesting that you said you read the book and you don't know the author. I said, but this is the last question I have. What other information do you have in regard to putting this expungement class together? What can you do, and what do we need to do to make this happen by the date you gave? And then I gave the phone back. I was pretty proud of myself because I wanted to tell her off because, you know, the whole Tuskegee. I'm like, you didn't even take the time to learn how to pronounce it right. You know what I'm saying? She just found this little, as they say, factoid, and she's throwing it out, you know. And I really hope that I can get this gentleman on cold, literally on cold, because he was just letting this woman berate him and just like, yeah, practice racism maximally over the phone. So I'll mute my line. I hope I didn't take too long. I'm a keep you in prayer, sir, with the daughter and everything. So Hotep, peace, be well, stay well.
Much obliged, Irie. Wow, that was got several different things, several different subject matters there. Lost for which one to, I guess I'll go with the last one that she touched on. I always think it's great to try to help out other victims of racism, and going into a situation and saying I'm going to try my best to be codified about things and make this as constructive as possible. And even though I can see some of the trappings of the four-wall setup, I'm going to see if I can do my best to overcome some of that and still make this constructive. Awesome effort. I guess keep us posted on how that goes. And I think it is spectacular. So frequently in dealing with racists, we want to, or we get encouraged, really provoked, to get emotional and get sidetracked. And, you know, I'm going to show you and tell off this white person and all this other stuff and stay in the question lane. And why am I talking to this white person? Like, what are we supposed to be doing? Like, are we supposed to be talking about the vaccine? I mean, where did we even get to with this? That's a major part of codification right there, especially when talking to a white person. Like, why are we talking to this person? What is our ultimate goal, objective? Let's make sure that we accomplish that. Get what we came for, as they say. And then, you know, everything else, if we got an extra 5 minutes, we can address some of these other things about COVID-19. What in the world? Like, let's get back to the expungement class. Like, is there anything that you're going to do with that? Or you just came to berate staff members about, like, what in the world? And then I just say, I'm tired. I don't want to hear anything else about Tuskegee. Tulsa, Oklahoma. We're done with the T's. Move on to another letter. Sesame Street. We're going to pick S or something far from T. A. B. Something else. No more Tulsa. No more Tuskegee. Job well done. Getting back on task. I guess it's not even a critique. Victims Guarantee qualified. I would say I love Harriet A. Washington. Merit Medical Apartheid. Like, top five Gus T. Renegade Book Club 2016. It might not have even been necessary to ask that, because are you a white person? Oh, okay. Are you going to help us with the expungement class? Did you commit to it? Like, let's just get back to that. Like, what in the world? And that I cannot say that enough. White people, that is one of the main ways they practice racism, wasting our time and distracting us from top priorities. That's how we end up with, we're not solving white supremacy racism. We're over on LGBTQ issues. Robert in Southern California. I think the television thing as well, because she gave some thoughts on that and talking about what's happening in the school. And I thought that was really important as well in terms of not shutting off communication. Like, it's always about minimizing conflict. And I think especially with young people, all of us make mistakes, and all the rest of it is young people, or as she said, just kind of feeling your way through metaphor, youth, and the whole process of what they call growing up or growing older, and trying to understand what's happening in the world. Not minimizing contact and kind of keeping it so that in a situation where they're already, it seems, blocking you from information and communication to try and keep communication flowing between you and your daughter in particular. I think that's spectacular. Asking questions, being a part of that, where you're not sometimes maybe not making as many statements, but asking questions to try to see what she's thinking about this whole process. I would only throw in as well, I think television is really important. I think Irie mentioned school. Television is just, man, I mean, it's difficult if you don't live in the same residence, but wow, to really minimize, if not eliminate, a lot of that television, because so much of that sexual confusion is right there on the screen, and then the types of music and what have you, media content that young people are exposed to that is greatly pushing the gender confusion, sexual confusion. Let's see. Other folks who, let me give out the number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Other attempted parents, again, no spectating. Robert in SoCal requesting some thoughts. Rough situation dealing with his daughter, trying to make the best decisions. If folks have any thoughts or input, that would be great. Other folks, other callers, line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter in Florida.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everyone. Now, first, would like to say that to share with Miss Irie is very easy, because she does do a great job of explaining her ideas and the things that she would like to see going on with her program. So she makes it very easy for a dummy like the retired firefighter to have a involving the sexual confusion. What I've been noticing over the, I guess over the last maybe 10 years is, you know, by nature itself, when a person is very, very young, you know, 5 years old, even before grade school, there is, you know, questions. Children ask a lot of questions, and there's a void there. There's a void there, to whereas parents have to be a lot more aggressive into paying attention to the questions that their child or children are asking, or maybe the actions that they're demonstrating, that sort of thing. Because under a global system of racist white supremacy, they are very aggressive at filling that void. Very aggressive. I'm talking about over my lifetime, the system, and I suspect it's a system of racist white supremacy, to whereas they have negotiated with venues such as television, public school system. You and I are at work as quote-unquote attempted parents, while some person is instructing your child on this subject matter, to whereas by the time that they are out of elementary school, they already have a base of this sexual confusion. And it is, I mean, I've been observing this over probably over the last 10 years on how accelerated, I mean, really accelerated. It's been happening with the technology that's available to a lot of people. It makes it even more advanced. Also, I think a lot of people would know about the incidents of violence that's been taking place down here in South Florida, gun violence that's been taking place. By the advent of non-white black people not putting the global system of racist white supremacy and all the shenanigans that goes along with that at the top of their list, logically speaking, things are going to get worse and worse, you know, from that standpoint, primarily where we're going to be acting more and more negatively, violently on each other. So we just have to have a, we got to be able to develop a code of understanding of what to do and what not to do, even amongst ourselves, is very vital as far as that's concerned. And that's all I have to say. Thank you for listening.
Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida. Just quickly, has that come up with the session that you and Mr. Clark do with the young folks, the young fellas on the weekends in terms of the sexual confusion, or do you all not really structure to address that?
We talk about it. You know, with the young fellas, even from a standpoint of male, female, you know, you have people who are at the age of quote unquote children who have access to pornography, you know? So, I mean, yeah, we have talks with them. And Mr. Clark has a way of being very direct. if you get the understanding of what I'm saying by saying very direct on the subject matter, you know, as far as that concerned. And sexually confused white people, well, they're not confused, but these sexually incorrect white people are aggressive with what they're doing, with their code on what they're doing. It's going to require for non-white people, especially non-white people who are racially classified as black, to become more and more aggressive. Because by the time your child is out of elementary school, the base, they already have that base. They already have that void filled as far as natural questions that children would ask on the subject of sex. You know, I mean, you can't even call a person male or female, him or her. I mean, a situation that is quite complicated. I put it that way. It's quite complicated, very aggressive. Did I answer your question?
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
Oh, okay. Okay. I kind of like, you got to watch me. I'll keep going on and on. And then I realize whether or not that I answered the person's question. Yeah. It's very, very aggressive. Very aggressive Mr. Tariq Nasheed was talking about it on his program, where they are actually selling, you know, the things that used to be kind of like behind closed doors, quote unquote, well, not really. I put it this way, since this is not a metaphor, they not really talked about. It's really present on a daily basis. They're selling artificial penises and whatnot for an example of how these things can be transferred from people who were born males to females and vice versa. It's even confusing to me to even be talking about it. the advent to whereas the governor of the state of Florida has to sign a document stating that it would be incorrect for males to have this sexual change to be able to participate in sports competing with females. I mean, and these children are not even they're not even in high school. They're still in middle school. And of course, we know it happens in high school. You know, as far as, I mean, it is very, very aggressive, and I would really like to see parents who are, you know, concerned about this to, you know, start reading some books, start finding out ways on how to be able to transfer this understanding, set this base for not just your offspring, if you have the permission, other non-white black people's offspring, because it is the competition, if you will, is very, very aggressive on what's going on right now, as far as the results would be sexual confusion. That's it.
Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida. When Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, when she would practically every time she was on a broadcast or just talking, period, to non-white people, black people, she would say, waiting. I think she'd put specific ages on it and saying for black people, males, no sooner than, I think it was 35, for females, no earlier than 30, before having children, not having children any closer than 2 years apart, like taking that act very seriously. And then there should be lots of discussion beforehand. I know I've talked frequently, like, hey, let's have a detailed dialogue about the first 5-10 years of our child's academic program, what that's going to look like. Irie, right there, as an educator, has said, hey, a lot of this is right there in the school system in terms of the confusion. White women educators, right there with all of this. And what are we going to do to circumvent that? Are we going to have independent school, or what are there, you know, African schools or whatever in our neighborhood? Or, you know, can we come up with something in that time period? Are we willing to move? That conversation, access to media, television, all of that. How are we going to explain all of the sexual confusion to them? Again, now you can circumvent some of that if you don't have them in the school system. That's a nice big chunk of it right there. Television. Being, you know, how you're going to control access to that, and how much TV watching, screen time you're going to allow. I think social media popped up on that. How are we going to manage social media? I know some parents say, you know, no social media accounts until way late. I think the later the better, as someone who is not an attempted parent, but the later the better. Like, I definitely think a 6-year-old should probably not have an Instagram account. Can't really think of a reason for a 10-year-old to have one either. So, yeah. All those dialogues way before we get to conception, that I think can be very effective, or is much better. I'll put it that way. I think that is a much better approach than waiting and then, oh my, seeing all of the damage that race soldiers have waiting for. You can't even say him and her anymore. Now, I mean, you talk about confusion. The brain computer, Dr. Welsing metaphor, purposely, but the brain computer of a 7-year-old, 8-year-old, 6-year-old, who's been told, you know, you're she and her all her life, and now it's, are you she or he or they or Zorg? Because this is what they, this, I'm serious, I just said Zorg. That's what they said on NPR. They're allowing them to make up their own pronouns, you know. You don't have to be trapped by this binary thing, you know. You're not a female, you're not a male, we'll make up something. What? And then I have to sit here and try to make, I thought I was a female, Aldi. Maybe I'm not. Maybe I am. You should talk about all of that way before conception. And if you, you know, did not realize the depths of the confusion, wow, you should go talk to some parents and see what attempted fathers and mommies like Rob in SoCal are having to deal with. It is wow. And as stated, I do not see any signs of it getting easier. The madness is intensive. Again, the technology, too, is advancing it greatly. Everybody has, you know, everybody has a cell phone. Even five-year-olds have a cell phone now. So, I mean, hey, the number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. We have other attempted parents. If you either are navigating this situation, have already dealt with it, maybe even if we have any folks, the metaphor they say, nipped it in the bud, you have stopped this from being a problem for you and your attempted children, you can dial and let us know that. Or if you have thoughts, suggestions on any of the other components that we discussed, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Make sure I also get in as well. We are listener supported. Counter Racist Radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. You can visit the blog racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. Much obliged to all of the investors who have kept the cows on air for 12 plus years, hopefully providing constructive information, what the system of white supremacy racism is, how it works. You can also hit our Cash App, the link, cash.app/$thecows. Huge gratitude to all the investors who have kept us broadcasting for more than a decade, hopefully worthy of your time and energy. You can also hit our wish list, Amazon.com, listed under Gus T. Renegade. Again, enormous thanks to all the folks who have nabbed an item or three over the years. Hope the cows has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. Man, Gus T. cut a fool this week. Metaphor. I got my wok from my wish list. I had wanted a wok for a while. For folks, if you are, you know, someone who's not a fan of vegetables, I think retired firefighter and I talked about this. That's another component. Healthy eating, super important. You can put all three of those right there together. What are we going to do about our child's academic plan? What are we going to do about sexual confusion in our offspring? What are we going to do about diet, not being on a diet, but food, health, nutrition? What are we going to do about that for our child? Breastfeeding the first few years, year, how long are we going to, all of that. Got to discuss that way before conception. But with the food component, like Gus T, I'm talking to myself, right, formally, and then many other people that I've talked to who have said they don't like vegetables. They grew up, you know, in a household where maybe people didn't do a lot of preparing of fresh fruits and vegetables. I know that was the case for me frequently, not all the time, but frequently. I'd be a lot of canned vegetables or frozen vegetables and not, you know, wild different ways of preparing fresh veggies to make them tasty and make them like the centerpiece of a meal. That was not happening in my house and seems to be the case for a lot of other people. A wok can really change the way, because many people that I know, they love Chinese food, Asian cooking, stir fries, they love that sort of thing. Woks are not super expensive items, thus I just got one from my wish list, but they're not very expensive, and they really, just sometimes the way that you prepare vegetables can really change how they taste, for the better or for the worst. And a wok, if you learn how to cook with a wok, I think some people have said they don't like the mushy vegetables when they're overcooked and soggy and limp and lifeless. Like cooking in a wok, I think most of the time if you have a stir fry, what they call Asian cooking, the vegetables are not all limp and overcooked and wilted. That is generally not the case. They have crispness and texture, and they're still vibrant. Like I christened my wok with sweet and sour cauliflower. I took pictures and egg rolls. I did not make the egg rolls in the wok. I just made those in my regular cast iron pot, but amazing. I didn't even post the pictures, but amazing. I just wish I had made more sauce. And then the next day I made fried rice. I made that bunch. I mean, we made that at the retreat, but now to be able to make it in the wok was so good. It's just, and it's quick. Like, it's high heat, so it's very quick. Like, with a wok, you should be done in 5 minutes. It takes more than 5 minutes. If it's a stir fry, you probably messed it up. Quick cooking, great taste. Get a wok. That would be my recommendation, especially if you're someone who complains about limp vegetables that are overcooked and soggy, that type of thing. Get a wok and learn how to cook with it. That, I guess, would be my other quick commentary before I get some of the other callers. Cooking in terms of a metaphor for being codified. Cooking, a lot of times, in terms of cooking well consistently, is you are codified, precise with doing things. I'm just noting an observation as someone who is not what they call a professional chef by any means, but I'm just noting an observation that I have heard many Black people, individuals classified as Black throughout my life, who have, I would say, bragged about not measuring ingredients when they cook. Professional chefs, almost in unison, they weigh ingredients. Normally when people cook, they have their measuring cups and measuring spoons and all that. So get a cup of flour and a teaspoon of nutmeg and all that. And the people who, this is how I pay my mortgage, is by what I do in the kitchen. They weigh ingredients almost unanimously. I struggle to even think of someone, white, non-white, who is like a professional cook who does not weigh ingredients, which they unanimously say is a much more precise way of measuring ingredients so that you can consistently execute dishes to a high quality level. Precise. That is the same way with counter-racist codification, being precise, often being very precise with words. You don't just say anything. You don't just throw anything in the pot. And just like with cooking and counter-racism, it is not a spectator activity. It is very different talking about making flapjacks and actually getting in the kitchen and doing some flipping of pancakes. Same with counter-racism. Very different doing some counter-racism and thought, speech, action yourself, just spectating or critiquing how another person, victim of racism, executes their attempt at counter-racism. Precision. Commonalities there. Let's see. Other folks that we have missed totally, if you have commentary to share, lines should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Caller in Florida? Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. I do also remember hearing a metaphor. I'm thinking it was from the farmer segment where it was something about the fox watching a hen house or something like that. So I couldn't even process, you know, how would they make that analogy? You know, who would be the hens and who was the fox? I don't even know. And from the Naomi Osaka, I think, segment, it sounded like the person that might have been a white person that was talking, and it looks like he was trying to imply that racism couldn't have played a part in the mental health cause of her quitting the tennis competition and whatnot. Like, it seemed like he was saying, oh, this is not about doing this and that. This is about something else. That's how it came off to me. And I just wanted to also add, there was an interesting news report that first it was, I saw it on the local station, and then it went on the more national news report shows. Two white children or teenagers were shooting at deputies in, I think it's called Enterprise, Florida, Volusia County, not too far from where I'm at. And it's very interesting how this story is being reported, because I know with like juveniles, minors, they blur out the faces. And in some reports, they showed their faces and told their names. The white female is 14. Looks like from how the story was reported, led the young white male, 12 years old, diabetic and everything like that. They ran away from this group home. From the reports said that the officers or the police department, sheriff's department, had to come out to that area on calls almost 300 times in the last year, from my understanding. And this young white girl, very violent, prone to criminality. But of course, you know, they didn't want to show that. They didn't want to really tell about that. But she's set homes on fire, attacked a hit one of the staff with a stick, and escaped this place, broke into someone's house, and armed herself with a pump shotgun, and is reported to have said by the young white boy, oh, I'm going to roll this out like GTA, okay, using assembly, violence, guns. And it was a comment that somebody made that said, hey, nobody said that they actually shot the officer. They just said that they were firing at the officers. So, yeah, they broke into some random person's home, got guns, AK-47 the 12-year-old had. So they didn't, nobody died. Like, they just got shot at or something. And they came out of the home. Yes, yes. Now, it doesn't end there. Now, they had all kinds of body cam footage. Oh, don't do this. Don't do this. So she comes out attempting to continue to shoot, like, you know, I got to kill somebody. That's what it seemed like. So they shot at her with precision, apparently. They said she got shot in the neck and a few other places. She's recovering right now. And then on the body cam footage, what is your name, sweetie? What is your name, sweetie? Like, after all of that, you know, so of course, white supremacy, after all of the victims of racism have been horribly treated and, beaten down and killed, murdered. And this is what happens when you have, white children, racist children, doing all of this, and then the sheriff's officer or the sheriff's police chief is up there like, what is going on with the juvenile department? I just don't get it. Is this, and also just one last thing, the dad, the father is on camera. I can't believe my 14-year-old daughter knows how to use a shotgun. So that's all I wanted to share. Thank you.
We are not going to make it. 2021, we are not going to make it. The Rona, white supremacy, racism. Apparently, racist man, racist woman, racist child, aka sweetie. We are not going to make it out of 2021. Before we get to the main part of caller in Florida's commentary, the metaphor not to be lost. I told you it was one every other sentence with the black farmers. So for the full context from NPR, they write, as a result, over the years, a skepticism of the USDA has deepened, and it affects how some farmers view the latest relief package. John Boyd, it's like the fox watching the hen house. Mr. Boyd is president of the National Black Farmers Association, and he's a Virginia. They don't say he's faced white supremacy racism. They say he faced loan discrimination. Now, back to these sweetie, young white children in Florida. I'm not going to read the whole Washington Post report. This is not my favorite publication, but I do check them from time to time. So we'll just pay attention to the language, as caller in Florida recommended. So their report is titled, Not Hooligans, Not Unruly Urchins. Nice alliteration there, right? They didn't go though. They went with Runaway Foster Children Broke Into Home, Found Guns, and Fired at Deputies, Sheriff Says. Statement of the facts. A 14-year-old girl and a 12-year-old boy in Florida face attempted murder charges after breaking into a home Tuesday and using the gun inside to fire at sheriff's deputies, authorities said in a violent and drawn-out confrontation that the children's foster home called the result of the system failing our children. What about the deadbeat parents? Deputies and the boy were not shot, the Volusia County Sheriff's Office said. The girl was taken to a hospital with life-threatening injuries and is now stable. Both children were runaways from Florida United Methodist Children's Home in Enterprise, according to authorities, who said they tried their best to de-escalate a situation that could have turned deadly. Don't make me do this, one deputy says to himself on sometimes dark and chaotic footage released Wednesday, worrying aloud that the children will emerge and force him to engage. They shot repeatedly toward deputies on four occasions over 35 minutes. Man, I don't think Tamir Rice got 35 seconds. Or John Crawford. Let me not get distracted. Let's see. 35 minutes, the sheriff's office said, before the girl finally emerged from the garage and pointed a shotgun at deputies, leading them to return fire. The boy, armed with an AK-47, then surrendered. The boy reportedly told authorities that the girl had said at one point, I'm going to roll this down like GTA, as stated, an apparent reference to the Grand Theft Auto video game series. Talked about media before, because they got all kinds of prostitution and what have you in this video game series that's like 25 years old, I think. Goes back to like the days when Doug Wilder was governor. GTA was coming out. Long running history. Very, very popular. All about killing and white supremacy culture. Riding around, having fun, shooting, killing, pillaging, prostitution, all the rest of it. Volusia County Sheriff Mike Chitwood railed against what he called a broken juvenile justice system at a news conference Wednesday, venting furiously against state officials and legislators. The president of the children's home, Kitwana McTyler, said the facility for young victims of trauma and neglect cannot be everything to everyone, and called the incident a prompt to address nationwide problems. A 12-year-old and a 14-year-old have it so bad in life that they are going to defy law enforcement and engage them in a gun battle, and the more we de-escalated, the more we tried to get the armored vehicles out here and pepper spray and tear gas, the more brazen they got. I'll stop there. Now, again, Tamir Rice, I think, didn't even get 35 seconds. He didn't have an AK-47 or a shotgun. And he didn't have a pal with him who's a couple years older with an AK-47 or shotgun or toy gun. John Crawford as well. He was an older person, so I guess if you're over 18, maybe you don't need two children. One black male over the age of 18 basically equals two children. So John Crawford, yeah. What to say? I find it fascinating that they immediately, everyone seems to go on attack that this is an indictment of the system. They don't even blame the parents. I think at minimum, if this had been two black children, at minimum, the parents would have been excoriated. Like, oh, they might not have had a picture of the children. Those parents, they would have been front and center. This is exactly what we're talking about. We went through 8 years of Obama to have you note count, lazy welfare queen, black parents, not take care of your children, and then you want us to sit around and pay you to not work during the... It would have been what they call it, throwing the book. Can we charge the parents with some sort of neglect and all? And he said they went to the foster home 300 times. Now, I have a difficult time imagining black foster parents, black regular parents, black people, period. They're not going to a rental James Simpson's house 300 times. We didn't hear that in the trial. They're not going retired firefighter in Florida's making too much noise and all the rest. They're not going to your house 300 times. Haven't we been up here before? Quiet down, fella. That's not going to happen. Like, you're going to get maybe a few, and then, hey, we've been up here a whole bunch of times. Don't make me come up here again. That's the speech that you're going to get, like, way before they get to visit 100, visit 50. It's going to be, hey, don't make me come up here again. 300 times. Come on. And then he said the father of this young woman says, I can't believe little Becky learned how to shoot a shotgun. My word. White people got YouTube videos more than you could watch in like 10 lifetimes of them with their little urchins, males and females, boys and gals, out shooting in the woods, bragging about, you know, I got my little one got first gun. She was 12 and we went out in the woods and we shot down a bear together and clawed it and killed it and skinned it and ran all the way. Get out of here. She know she probably got her initials monogrammed on the shotgun. Like, I got special bullets for these. Been shooting them since I was 5. Look at there. Got my pictures right there. Started kindergarten. Started shooting at the same time. Look at that. Reading, writing, rifle, racism. Got all my R's. Same time. Check the news. I'll say again. Right there in the paper. This incident. I just can't imagine if these were two black children. I cannot imagine. They both would have been dead. The parents would have been excoriated. I can't think of the language. I suspect would have been quite a bit different, but we would have definitely had some fatalities. This little white woman would not have been in a stable condition. She would have been dead. Probably the white fella too, 12 and 14 year old. They would have been dead and the parents would have been excoriated, maybe charged. Any other comments folks need to get in before we wrap up? We basically did our 3 hours. Everybody satisfied?
Can I be heard?
Rob in SoCal, yes, sir.
Just before we end, I just had a very interesting experience in a convenience store that I frequent. And I'm sure that this experience is pretty widespread, but he's seen me come in with female patrons before, and I go in there, and he took this time to ask me about the female friends that he has seen me frequent the establishment with, and I kindly had to ask him a question. When I come into this establishment, do I ask or question you about your wife and or the female counterparts that you engage with? And I had to ask that question a couple of times. He finally answered the question and acknowledged that I did not ask him those type of questions, and that when I come into this establishment, the best procedure would be to keep it strictly business, strictly a transaction. Thank you, and thank you for the program.
Questions. I love it. Heard that from Irie. Questions can neutralize a lot of different behaviors. When people are not engaging you in an appropriate manner and just being professional, operate your establishment, engage in the transaction. Thank you for your patronage. We'll see you soon. That's it. Whoa. When you were telling me that, I was almost thinking, like, is this some kind of proposition? Like, ooh, can you hook me up with some black ladies type of a thing? Because we heard that yesterday. That's nothing about that sounds like it's going anywhere constructive. I mean, just administratively, oh, is your lovely wife or girlfriend with you today? You by yourself? Oh, okay, right on. Good scene. Anything other than that, just keep it business. Great job asking the questions. Irie in Louisiana, were you going to get in something before we wrap up? Were you satisfied?
Yeah, thanks. So I wanted to share this. Like two Saturdays ago, I can't remember why exactly, but there's a law. You were talking about, I think, a sex crime victim, and it reminded me of Crystal Kaiser, victim of racism in Wisconsin. So they're trying to get a law passed called Marcy's Law that's supposed to help protect victims like her. But they said that basically, just a quote, in Ohio, one victim claims that in Florida and South Dakota, police officers who have shot and armed or killed people claim victim status and asserting they were acting in the interest of the public while carrying out the shootings. And I found that to be interesting. And I don't know how prevalent a law like that is in other states, but I wanted to share that. They always finding ways of upholding and, you know, not being different. Good night, everybody.
Much obliged. Florida, man. Pay attention to the news in Florida. I guess everybody, even if you don't live in Florida, that Governor DeSantis, they're always up to something, man. Sometimes they tip a whole election down in flipping Florida, man. So Marcy's Law, it's spelled M-A-R-S-Y. Marcy's Law. I'm reading from the Orlando Sentinel. We were in Orlando, the Cows Yoga Retreat in 2019. Marcy's Law leads to dangerous secret keeping in Florida. Now, see, that right there, we consistently talk about how do racists conceal information from non-white people? Newer method. I'm not going to read the whole report. It says, on its face, Marcy's Law sounded splendid. Empower victims and protect their privacy. Except it was never really that simple, and now we're seeing proof all over Florida. In Fort Myers, police said they couldn't release a sketch of a suspect who'd attacked a woman, even though the suspect was on the loose, because the victim wanted privacy surrounding the case. In Sarasota, the sheriff's office reported a bank robbery, but wouldn't say which bank was robbed. Why? The bank was the victim. In another Sarasota case, the sheriff's office charged a daycare employee with child neglect, but said Marcy's Law prevented them from telling the public which daycare employed the accused criminal. And here's a particularly mind-numbing one. After someone broke into my coworker's car, she requested a police report of the incident for insurance purposes, only to see the department had blacked out most details, including her own name. The department considered her a victim who needed her privacy shielded from herself. Let's see. Oh, and they say Florida citizens voted on this. I guess they did not maybe explain the different ways that this would be applied in law. But wow, lots of ways information ends up being concealed so that you don't have all of the details to make great decisions. This is Marcy's Law leads to dangerous secret keeping in Florida. Anything like that benefits racism, white supremacy. Anything that helps or supports concealing less information being released, we're able to redact more, that strengthens the system. That's our 3 hours. We will conclude there. Excited, Labyrinth, the assassination of Tupac Shakur, Notorious B.I.G., and LAPD corruption. That is our follow-up 1, 2, 3, O.J. Simpson, Geronimo Pratt, these cases. Rodney King is in there. Rodney King, the trial, all that is a huge component of this book we're about to start as well. So, Labyrinth, Robert Sullivan, this Thursday. Stay tuned for other broadcasts in the meantime. Sobriety would be best for a host of reasons. That's another component of all that sexual confusion. Have people where they're not really thinking correctly, a little bit intoxicated, so you don't make the best decisions. And that can be the environment to experiment, try something new. Sobriety would be best. I've said going out and about, like, there should be a thought process. Like, people could be the runaway 12 and 14 year old foster children could be armed. It is dangerous times. We had the report, the news segments, huge number, record number of gun owners. Lots to be mindful about when you're out in public. It is not really a good time. The clip that we started with, Gastonia, North Carolina, someone, road rage incident or whatever it is, this is not the time to be confronting folks. You should be thinking, like, this person may be armed. Like, I don't care if it's a 10-year-old. This person could be armed. Like, if you didn't leave your residence prepared to kill and or die, exit. This is not about following and tracking somebody down and I'm going to shoot at you or shout at you. Excuse me. I'm going to shout and be yelling at an ant. Distance. Exit. Get out of there. Make whatever report you need to later. But it is super dangerous right now. The foster children at 12-year-old got AK-47s and shotguns. Like, man, it is dangerous time. And they're still sweetie, by the way. I can't imagine if they had been black. I mean, caller in Florida made note of it, but I mean, geez, if that had been Tamir Rice, he would not work. URC, he was not sweetie. Tamir Rice could have been 6 and he would not have been sweetie. And he probably even then didn't even get 35 seconds. Anyway, if you are going to go out and about, if you're driving, you're not on the cell phone. We need all of our attention to be paying, being mindful about what's happening around us. And then we're not on the cell phone. We're trying to do the small things that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. All of that said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. Say it again, no name calling. Just small things that we can do. No name calling is one, no gossiping, another, just little things that would make a huge impact, and particularly minimizing conflict with other non-white people. Little things that we can do. No name calling, no gossiping. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.